This is brought to you by Blondie's Detroit. The legendary Blondie's is back to rock the Motor City, located on 4th Street in Detroit.
101.1 WRIF in WRIF HD1 Detroit. Welcome to the award-winning Night Call, the Riff's phone-in talk show on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
Well, thank you very much, and welcome to the broadcast, joined by Jalene Jordan. Hi, Jalene.
Hi, Peter.
Jalene Jordan will not be able to read anything until Al Slayer fixes her glasses.
He didn't know this was in his job description.
Yeah.
But
how are you coming there, Al?
Oh, I'm working on it. I think we're almost there.
It's the ever-expanding job description here at Night Call.
Right. And, hey, Riff fans, Al Slayer, you're doing overnights. What, Monday through Friday?
Is it? Yeah.
To what, you
catch
start,
his show.
You started what? Midnight.
Midnight. Here with Midnight Metal.
Nighttime is
every
the right time.
Every weeknight, right?
Yeah. We showed a great remake of the old Bob Seger song, 2 Plus 2 by Powertrain. The old war horse of Detroit rock and roll, Scotty Morgan.
And that was what the show wrapped up with.
Yeah, the Motor City Riff. Which Al Slayer
produces, co-host,
and you can also hear him on Riff 2.
He's all over the place.
Yeah, right. He's an engineer. He sweeps up, shovels snow.
All of those, three nights in a row without going home has really paid off for him.
Co-produces this show.
I'm not confident that they're not going to fall apart.
All right. My glasses, everybody.
Sorry. He's only halfway in.
So send those emails. I can read them now. Thanks, Al.
Are we in there?
We are.
Hey, hi, everybody.
This is a call-in talk show.
Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan, 313-298-WRI.
313-298-9743.
If you'd like to email us, if you're bashful or if the lines are filled, which I haven't even looked, let me get my little mousey here.
Just a couple of them. We've got more open lines.
People are calling already, huh? We haven't even brought up a subject.
You know what? I think that oftentimes people are just, they have it ready because they think, I'm going to call the Werby Show, as a lot of people call it. I'm going to call the Werby Show on Sunday. I'm going to ask him. He'll answer that.
Upside down, found on his car. That's what one of the top. We have this little board here. Anyway, call talkyes@yahoo.com. Call talkyes@yahoo.com. And if you even want a slight chance of having it read on the air, please make it very short. And in general, if you're writing me, some people they don't believe in paragraphs, and it's extraordinarily hard to read.
Well, especially when you're dealing with a couple of ADDers like us.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, we both kind of look at it and just go, I can't deal with this right now.
I have to say, I don't know if I dare admit this in our fair city, but I haven't been a big fan of the Tigers since they moved to the new stadium. I kind of swore allegiance, one of these...
Diehard.
Diehard. That's the word I was looking for. In fact, I have to say that I swore I would never go to the new stadium.
Have you? And you have not been there?
A friend of mine in the Illich organization, the owner, took me through a tour when no one was there, but I've never seen a game there.
I've never seen a game there either, but I have seen the Rolling Stones there.
Really?
Yes.
Wow. Well, one of the big stars is, of course, Maglio
Ordóñez.
Yeah. What were you making hand signals?
I was thanking him for fixing my glasses.
Yeah. Maglio.
Maglio Ordóñez.
Yeah, one of the great players in the leagues today. He received in Miami a mix of boos and cheers from Venezuela fans Monday night at the World Baseball Classic. And Ordóñez was playing for the national team, the Venezuelan team. Detroit Tigers slugger, one of his country's biggest baseball stars, infuriated many Venezuelans recently by backing the constitutional amendment that ended term limits for President Hugo Chavez.
So these people don't want Chavez there forever, and he doesn't care.
They're like the anti-Castro Cubans. So Ordóñez was booed repeatedly by anti-Chavez Venezuelan fans during Saturday's 3-1 victory over the Netherlands. Many in the crowd cheered loudly when he struck out in the fourth inning.
I'm sure it was a little bit unnerving.
Yeah, he was. Well, he's always going for the fences. That's probably why he struck out. I don't know how he does in strikeouts, but a lot of those sluggers also have high strikeout records as well.
Okay.
He was booed again during pregame introductions and his first at-bat against Puerto Rico, although this time there were shouts of support as well. Ordóñez said before the game, "I don't regret anything."
Really?
Yeah. Most Venezuelans in South Florida oppose the left-leaning Chavez and his socialist beliefs, but polls and repeated election results show most support him at home. Chavez, that is. That even became an issue back in Venezuela. Chavez referred to the incident on his Sunday program, saying everyone has the right to think about politics. Well, that was a weighty statement. He said, "Viva Maglio and all our compatriots," after reading a story about the booze. That's B-O-O-S.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. Ordóñez called President Chavez's support an honor, but said he was shrugging off the controversy. He says, "I carry the name of Venezuela on my chest. I've earned that page. I've turned that page, rather."
Okay.
Which means almost as little as my slip. I don't know what that means. "Those are things that can't be controlled." This sentence makes no sense. It's an honor to hear this. It's an honor for me to represent Venezuela. Some fans seem to be putting it in the past as well. There were cheers among the boos for Ordóñez on Monday, and fans leaned over the Venezuela dugout before the game, pleading for his autograph. Now, when I was in Caracas, there was the national championships for the Venezuela, for the country.
For baseball?
Yeah, for baseball.
Okay.
And most of the people there, well, I mean, we were watching a speech by Chavez, which was actually pretty boring, but I was, you know, testing my Spanish. Hey, it was kind of boilerplate politician talk. But the Leones were playing the Tigres for the national championships, which is odd since Ordóñez is a...
The Tigre.
Is a Tigre, yeah. And the Leones is a lion.
That is very ironic. You know, I think Ordóñez would like this show.
Maglio.
We talk about your country all the time.
Give us a shout, man. Well, he's in Florida now anyways, isn't he?
Oh, he is. I think we should arrange a meeting.
Well, I don't know what to say about this economic thing. I just get more and more, resistant to trying to figure it all out. I mean, it's...
Which part? This financial
any
stuff?
Any of it. Yeah, that's what I mean.
It really is confusing.
I mean, it's not a bad rule of thumb to say that if the Republicans support it, you should oppose it, and if the Republicans oppose it, you should support it. And, of course, they're really hammering Obama on these bailout plans. And,
they're on him. They're on his butt.
Yeah, and this increased purchase of debt and trying to get these financial institutions rolling again. In fact, congressional Republicans Sunday predicted a doomsday scenario of crushing debt and eventual federal bankruptcy if President Barack Obama's massive spending blueprint wins passage. Well, you know, it is kind of scary. And he is putting a lot of money out there on debt.
Extremely scary.
Yeah. White House.
The debt is, go ahead.
Big.
But I'd rather try to fix things than spend it on war.
Yeah, but the problem with the Obama administration, he's doing both.
That's true.
Yeah.
And then talking about going into Pakistan?
Yeah.
Whole other thing there.
A White House advisor dismissed the negative assessments, saying she is incredibly confident that the president's policies will do the job for the economy. Well, you really don't know what to think, because I could imagine either occurring, actually. You know, that it just that it is a doomsday scenario of crushing debt. I mean, that's what Bush began by spending the country into debt, by relaxing taxes on corporations and the very wealthy, and taking the country to war. So we began with debt. I mean, that's what Barack Obama inherited. He inherited a recession caused by Bush and Reaganomics, and also a federal debt that had been brought on by his spending and taxation policies. So I don't know what to do. I mean, what Barack Obama Obama is trying to do, being a centrist moderate, is to fix capitalism as it currently exists. So naturally, he's going to go to fix the main institutions of the system. I don't know. I'm not 100% sure what else he can do. I mean, it's all frightening, whichever way you look at it. I mean, the Republicans, I mean, they're actually talking about what they should do for job creation is do more tax cuts so that would limit the revenue of the government. And, I mean, can you have an economy? I mean, well let's put it this way. The economy has always been based on the big guys, not on the little guys.
Yeah.
And so what Barack Obama is trying to do in the manner that Bush did with the first hundreds of billions of dollars bailout in October, was to fix the big guys. The big guys are the centerpiece of capitalist society, not only in the United States, but in the world. And it's all about finance. It's all about stock markets. It's all about, industrial production is sort of another thing. But a lot of it is just this mystery crapshoot,
right,
called finance.
Yeah, and that's pretty much, someone asked me, you know, can you explain any of this to me? And I said, well, it really comes down to two words. And they just kind of looked at me like, really?
Bull, no.
Crapshoot.
No, crapshoot. Yeah, I was thinking bullcrap, but it doesn't help.
Yeah, that too.
Well, what, although there is, I mean, I want to be wary of these criticisms that say that this could wind up to be an extraordinary disaster. But, you know, and I was thinking about this AIG, everybody's, understandably, so am I, just so outraged, that's the big word, outraged, I'm outraged, that these executives, these losers, have gotten all this money, hundreds of millions of dollars, and part of it out of our tax dollars. So we work, a lot of us, for not very much, and then it goes to these ultra wealthy guys that created what's hurting the littlest people and some of the middle class people as well. So there's obviously no justice there. I mean, as they say at the top, there's just us, and they forget about the other 90%. But the rich always get favorable treatment and favored treatment. There's nothing any different, and most of these people have never said a thing about it. I mean, you've never said back in, say, the 1990s, hey, these people are all getting favorable treatment. Hey, there's this increasing maldistribution of wealth in this. Hey, the middle class's income and wealth is stagnant. It's falling for many people in the working sector. All of a sudden, there's this one little blip where these corporate criminals get, you can see it now. It's out in the light of day, and a lot of people are really hurting. Suddenly, everybody's got their backup. Well, I don't understand why they didn't get their backup a year ago, 5 years ago, 10 years ago.
Yeah.
You're older, 20 years ago, 30 years ago.
Well, it takes a personal crisis.
Yeah.
For a lot of people to get it.
Well, a lot of it's been whipped up. They have these things called tea parties that have been whipped up by the right wing. I mean, some of them are really big. There was an Orlando Tea Party, a rally that drew 4,000 people, and it was put together by this, in fact, they even called it a conservative rally, put together by this conservative radio host. And he said, what's his name here? Bud Hedinger, I guess, something like that. This is maybe the greatest single gathering of God-fearing patriots in the history of Orlando, Florida. Well, you can tell these people got nothing on the ball because, words. Repeal the pork or our bacon is cooked, or Obama lied, liberty died. That's really interesting. That's a whole transformation of that slogan, which is a little more potent, which says Bush lied, people died. Yeah.
I had that on my car for a long time.
Yeah. And they're talking about here, Debbie Weissenant said, the problem with socialism is that you eventually run out of other people's money. And so what do they suggest? Let me see. I don't know. They need to shove the bum out, one guy said. Okay. Everything's gone to the dog, said Frankie Austin. This is absolutely no way as a nation we can sustain that kind of spending. All right. Well, there's somebody finally with maybe a little something to say. Oh, well, let me see here. Ordóñez didn't do very well during this World Baseball Classic. He batted 208. Thank you, Roger.
Doesn't mean anything to me. I don't know what that means. I really don't.
That means, if you hit, like, say, 335.
Okay.
You're a big-time hitter. It's like .335.
Okay.
And, which means you didn't get a hit two-thirds of the time.
No.
But you're really good. I mean, I don't think there's been anybody, I don't know, since maybe the 40s, that anybody's batted in baseball, what they call 400. And they have these little, they have the third decimal point on there because they have these batting championships. And, you know, there'd be maybe 20 guys that are batting 33. So they got to put point on there because one guy's batting 338, another guy's batting 334.
Okay.
So, but essentially what it means, even when somebody, Roger knows all of this. Oh, Ted Williams was the last. I was just going to say.
Oh!
Yeah.
I know that name.
Yeah. And it says 300, Roger says 300 is great, 250 is SH. I'm sorry. We're both having glasses problems.
We're a mess.
I actually can't tell whether that's an E or an S. But in any event, but you're talking about 5% different, really. But Ted Williams batted something like 406 or 408, which meant 60% of the time he didn't get a hit.
Right.
So,
but
pitching,
it's still good.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, pitching going 90 miles an hour, 95 miles an hour in some cases.
Yeah.
Pretty hard to hit those things.
Oh, I can't imagine.
Are we on the air? Oh, yeah, sorry.
Thank you for the baseball lesson.
Yeah, Roger's on top of it. Roger is on top. Let's see. What else is here? Oh, yeah. Protesters visit AIG officials' lavish Connecticut homes. I like this. A buttload of activists representing working and middle-class families paid visit Saturday to the lavish homes of American International Group executives to protest the tens of millions of dollars in bonuses awarded by the struggling insurance company after it received a massive federal bailout.
Where are they? Are they in D.C.?
No, although there was anybody go to there. It was a big anti-war
big,
demonstration.
Yeah.
Well, maybe it wasn't big, was it?
Well, it's one of the big ones.
Yeah.
I don't know how well it was attended.
I'll bet we've been to ones, what, 500,000?
Well, the paper said hundreds, which I just thought, I don't even know. We know it's low.
I mean, yesterday's?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll bet you there was 5,000.
Right.
Which is low for the ones that have been 500,000 and all.
But I tell you, if I could have been at this AIG protest in front of their houses, I would have been there in a heartbeat.
You would have been one of the buttload of activists.
Yeah,
right?
I would have. Yeah. I would have had my butt over there.
Let's see. About 40 protesters sought to urge AIG executives who received a portion of $165 million in bonuses to do more than help families. We think $165 million could be used in a more appropriate way to keep people in their homes, create more jobs and health care, said Emily Bravo Blackport, a gardener. Oh, a mere gardener, probably at the homes of... Yeah, she marveled at AIG executive James Haas's Colonial House, which has stunning views of a golf course in the Long Island Sound. The Fairfield House is another part of the world
New
from
York.
Her life. Yeah. I don't know if you can see your geography, but Connecticut, you can look down onto Long Island. There's a ferry that goes...
Yeah.
All right, so... I don't know what to I mean, this, I don't, well, you can tell this is difficult for me because where we're at is extraordinarily challenging. Let's put it like that. Because which way do we go with it all? Like I say, I don't think the Republicans have any answer whatsoever, and they're the ones that got us into this. And, I mean, the Democrats came along with a lot of it as well. But mainly, it's Reaganomics. It's supply-side economics. It's the idea of rewarding the rich. And it's the old-fashioned, wealthy strategy of trickle-down economics. Well, a little bit of it trickles down. But what started happening was less and less of it trickled down. So the wealthy used it for all this speculative capital. This was the grand casino of the stock market and created all these bubbles. This has happened any number of times before in even world history. And at one point, it all just blows up in... A few of their faces, but you know...
Our faces.
Yeah, it's mostly our faces, the average person, our friends. Now, Nokia, the phone company, you know, I always thought they were from Japan.
Oh, well, me too.
Finland.
Really?
Yeah. In fact, and one of our Finnish fans can tell us how to pronounce O-Y-J. It's Nokia O-Y-J, the word oich. or something.
Okay.
They're going to slash 1,700 jobs globally over the coming few months because of the falling demand. They're the world's top cell phone maker, by the way, if you didn't know that. The overall cell phone market is expected to contract by about 10% this year, hurt as consumers rein in spending and handset sellers try to clear out unsold phones.
Mm.
Now, what this system needs, and that's the problem, and it's all related to the stock market and what have you, is there has to be not only endless production and consumption, but there always has to be a rise in it. Because, like last year, ExxonMobil ripped us off more than they ever had at any time in their history and more than any corporation ever had in the history of the world. So they had the highest profit of any company ever, up in the billions, and I can't remember exactly what it was. I don't know. Maybe it was just about $50 billion, some little figure like that, maybe more. But in any event, their stock price actually dropped because they didn't do quite as well as the Wall Street expectations. This is for the last 3 months of last year. So this is insane. This can't just keep going on. You can't produce more and more. You can't just keep consuming more and more. You can't keep putting more and more cars on the road. Now they have this car called the Tata.
Oh, yeah, what is that?
It's $2,500. Mm-hmm. It's made in India. And, of course, all the car companies of the world want to bring China into the consumer market. And since we're going to run all of our cars on what? What are we going to run all of our cars on?
Hey, Peter, on what?
Because it's all about the price of oil.
Yes.
It's all about the price of oil.
Yeah, Billy Bragg.
Know it.
Yeah, and that's what the wars are about, and that's what the coming wars are going to be about as well.
Peter, we got an email, and this is something that if anyone is really angry, we just talked about protesting in front of the AIG executives' homes. There is a protest, a demo at Wall Street, and it's the Detroit Area Peace with Justice Network. Bus will be going. It's a big demo, Beyond War, A New Economy is Possible, and it's April 3rd, right at April 3rd. So
it's April 4th.
Leaving April 3rd, it is April 4th, and comes back, be back Sunday morning.
Yeah, this is one of these bus rides.
$85.
I want to tell you, these people have such incredible stamina. They leave Friday night, they drive in the buses all night.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, man, it's even farther than
New York.
Washington.
This is dedication.
Oh.
But it's great, a great cheap way to go. I'm telling you, $85 round trip.
Yeah. And then you protest, and then you come back. You can go to unitedforpeace.org.
And you know what, though? You usually may end up making lifelong friendships and connections. It's a great thing to do.
Yeah, it is indeed. David Brooks, who is a smarmy intellectual conservative, he says, over the centuries, the United States, this was in the New York Times on the 17th of March, has been most conspicuous for one trait, manic energy. And I would say that's the problem. I mean, manic energy does produce some things, I have to say. On the other hand, as he says, and I don't know why he's not critical of this, Americans work longer hours than any other people. Oh,
yeah.
Well, isn't that swell? We switch jobs more frequently, move more often, earn more, and consume more. It's not, I don't want to get into every little clause. See, that's the problem with quoting conservatives. They usually have, there's so much in it. Every clause, you go, well, you know what? Actually, but I'll never get through this. This energy was first aroused by abundance, by the tantalizing sense that dazzling wealth was available just over the next hill. But it also has been sustained by a popular culture that celebrates commercial ambition. The gospel gets dented during each of the nation's financial crises, but it always returns with a vengeance. The late 19th century was a time of economic turmoil. I mean, it was class warfare where National Guards were shooting down striking workers and whole families, what have you, when they tried to unionize. It was also a time when this commercial creed was preached most fervently. Andrew Carnegie, who was responsible for shooting down his share of workers, actually, he didn't, of course. He never got his fingernails dirty. He had his Pinkertons, and when he could get the National Guard to come out anyway, he published something called The Gospel of Wealth. Albert Hubbard published A Message to Garcia, which celebrated industriousness and ambition, sold 40 million copies. The Baptist minister, Russell Conwell traveled the country delivering his Acres of Diamonds sermon to rapturous audiences more than 6,000 times. Back before the internet and television and radio, people would get a speech and just do it over and over. The 1898 Democratic Party candidate was William Jennings Bryan, mostly known for he defended, all of a sudden it's out of my mind. The Scopes, was that? It must have been his name. The Darwin challenge in... that was
the Scopes trial.
The Scopes trial.
That.
Yeah, yeah. What's I'm trying to think of the movie with Spencer Tracy and somebody else.
Oh yeah, darn it! And it was just on the other day.
Was it?
Yeah.
Anyway, that was about evolution, and Scopes was tried in this Tennessee town for teaching evolution, and William Jennings Bryan defended him. Anyway, he gave this speech called his Cross of Gold speech, and he said, "You shall not crucify man. You shall not crucify mankind on a cross of gold." And it was about
wealth
and how, you know.
Interesting.
Yeah. He gave that speech hundreds, maybe thousands of times. And people that had heard it, say, in 1900 brought their children to see it, like in 1923 and what have you.
Really?
Yeah.
Ah.
Yeah. The United States will never be Europe. It was born as a commercial republic. It's addicted to the pace of commercial enterprise. After periodic pauses, says David Brooks, the country inevitably returns to its elemental nature. So there never can be any workers of the world relax. It's always this...
We have to continually unite.
Yeah, and continually work.
You
can't...
if you can get it.
Yeah, well, I mean, you can't have an economy of stasis where everything is in balance. But so if everybody's not manically buying cell phones, Nokia's laying off people. I mean, it's understandable. I mean, it all is about supply and demand, right? But it just seems to me that there ought to be a way that that we don't have to be the people that are working the most in the world, as David Brooks says. That maybe we could find a way... to do some stuff outside of work that would be more rewarding.
I'm all for that.
There was an article I got last week, which I'd never read. I'm just going to read the headline. Extreme cheapskates, tightwads revel in frugality. And they're talking about these people. Actually, maybe I did mention it. It says the trend is disturbing for merchants who are already reeling from the sharp pullback by spenders. Such extreme miserly behavior could only worsen the decline in consumer spending. I was talking about friends that only bought at thrift shops. And if you do that, you're like, destroying the economy.
Well, I know a whole lot of people doing that.
Yeah, what?
Going to Salvo.
Yeah. Well, you've sent this to me. Walmart awards $2 billion to U.S. hourly employees. Wow.
Yeah, so what do you think about that?
I don't know.
You know, to me it was like, okay, what's wrong with this picture? I know there's something wrong. Walmart.
You know that old saying about figures don't lie, but liars can figure.
Yeah.
But they say Walmart, I assume they are. Walmart Stores Incorporated is awarding approximately $2 billion to its U.S. hourly employees through financial incentives, including handing out almost $1 billion in bonuses on Thursday after the largest retailer gained market share amid a recession. In a memo to Walmart employees, the new CEO, Mike Duke, said the retailer is awarding roughly $2 billion to U.S. hourly employees, which includes bonuses, profit sharing, 401k contributions, millions of dollars in merchandise discounts, and contributions to its employee stock purchase plan. Well, maybe they finally got a little bit of conscience, and they're starting to return a bit of this to the workers they've screwed for so long at such abysmal wages. And when they try to unionize, it is like the, you know, like the 1890s or something. Well, they're not bringing out the National Guard, but they just close, they close stores if they get unionized. As consumers seek to stretch limited budgets, they're increasingly heading to Walmart's U.S. stores for discounts on everything from food to television. Walmart is also aggressively touting its low prices to attract shoppers, and the retailer said on Thursday it is cutting prices on contact lenses and children's glasses. Well, what they're doing, of course, and we've talked about this before, how they're able to get these low prices is because of their buying volume that they they can dictate prices, particularly to Asian suppliers, which means these people working in Asia gotta just get the crappiest wages. The movie we were trying to talk about is Inherit the Wind.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you, Roger. Roger, do you know all this stuff, or do you just, I mean, you got the computer in the other room.
And the phone.
And the phone, right, or maybe, maybe somebody, he says, I know a bit. Baseball, yes. He knows a little, and he can guess the
Spencer
rest.
Tracy movies?
Yeah. Spencer Tracy, and I can see the other guy. Who's the other guy? Who played, it was Clarence Darrow, of course, the famed liberal radical lawyer that defended so many cases back in that period from, like, the 1890s through, I don't know what, the 1920s. I've got it completely wrong.
You
I'm
do?
Surprised, yes. I mean, nobody told me.
Because I don't know.
Right. It was because Clarence Darrow defended Scopes, and William Jennings Bryan was defending the town of blah, blah, Tennessee.
You had it all mixed up.
I'm all mixed up. Well, I'm going to recompose myself as we take a quick break, and some of you have been patiently waiting. We'll get to your calls in just a minute. A couple open lines, though. 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
I'm Peter Werby, and Jalene Jordan is here with me. Give us a call.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more of your calls right after this. On your radio, on your computer, and now on your brand new iPhone 3G. Your new Apple iPhone 3G connects you to 101 WRIF from anywhere in the world.
Damn, we're going to get you in a room.
Log on and listen worldwide at WRIF.com. The Riff.
Hey, great tent. Got it at REI. They're a co-op. A what? You get an annual refund. Cool.
Just how great can the great outdoors be? Find out. Visit the REI Member Rewards event. Members save 20% on camping, backpacking, and hiking gear. Offer ends March 29th. Visit your local REI or REI.com. REI. Find out. Offer for one full price item. Exclusions apply.
If your credit card debt has gotten out of control, if you're over your head at monthly payments, here's one powerful secret the credit card companies don't want you to know. You have the right to settle your credit card debt for a fraction of what you owe, allowing you to cut your debt up to half or more. That's bad news for credit card companies, but it's great news for you. We're Consumer Debt Advocate, and we'd like to offer you a free consultation that will help you start eliminating credit card debt. For your free consultation that will set you free, call 1-800-984-6953. Don't ruin your credit by declaring bankruptcy. Settle your debt and move on with your life. During your free consultation, you'll find out what the credit card companies don't want you to know. For your free consultation that will help you settle your credit card debt for a fraction of what you owe, call today. The number is 1-800-984-6953. 1-800-984-6953.
If you have acne, here's a phone number you need to call. 1-800-335-4191. Right now, we're looking for the biggest skeptics out there to test out a skin-clearing breakthrough risk-free. If that's you, give us a call. We're going to prove you can make your acne disappear and have clear skin by sending you a 60-day trial of Proactive Solution absolutely risk-free with our compliments. And when you call now, we'll also send you our Green Tea Moisturizer, a feather-light serum that absorbs instantly to deliver deep hydration for free. Call 1-800-335-4191. Our combination therapy system uses prescription-grade acne medicine. It's so effective, it transforms blemishes and bumps into clear, smooth skin and skeptics into believers. You can have beautiful, healthy-looking skin. Put Proactive to the test, and we'll prove it. Get your free soothing green tea moisturizer with your risk-free 60-day trial by calling now. 1-800-335-4191. 1-800-335-4191.
Is your debt getting bigger? Are you falling behind on your bills and receiving collection calls? Well, it's not your fault. Millions of Americans are buried in credit card debt because of a job loss, divorce, medical bills, or just bad luck. But now there's a way you can get debt-free faster than you ever imagined. Call Credit Guard of America today for free information, and you'll learn how you can cut your monthly payments by up to half, lower or even eliminate your interest rates, and stop the collection calls once and for all. For free information, call 1-800-709-6136.
We owed $25,000 to the credit card companies. This year, we're going to be debt-free.
Credit Guard of America won't just help you get debt-free. We'll even show you how to improve your credit status.
They helped me pay off 10 credit cards and rebuild my credit rating.
Call us today to learn how you can cut your monthly payments by up to half and get debt-free. For free information, call 1-800-709-6136. That's 1-800-709-6136.
You may have seen her on Oprah or The View. We're talking to Lucinda Bassett, founder of the Midwest Center, about a powerful free tape she's giving away to help people discover a way to leave anxiety and depression behind for good. Lucinda, what are some of the symptoms of anxiety?
Worry, fear, depression, insecurity, low self-esteem. I suffered with anxiety and depression for over 20 years. When I was at my lowest point, I was curled up in a ball on my living room sofa, afraid to live and afraid to die.
Wow. So what's the biggest anxiety myth?
I think the most challenging thing about working with people with anxiety and depression is that many of them think they're victims of their emotions. They think they'll always be worrisome, fearful, and depressed.
But that's not true.
There's real drug-free help that has the potential to last a lifetime. Millions of people have called for this wonderful free tape.
Okay, to request your free tape, call 1-800-449-7603. 1-800-449-7603. 1-800-449-7603.
If you want to own a new computer but think you can't get credit, listen to this. Now you're approved for a brand new Dell, HP, or other name brand computer for just $29.99 a week. There's no credit check, no hassles, and you won't be turned down. Just call Tronics Country at 1-800-990-2258. If you have a bank account and can afford weekly payments of just $29.99 for 12 months, you're approved for a new computer guaranteed. Even if you have bad credit or no credit, you will not be turned down. And with Tronics Country's program, you can help improve your credit rating. Call Tronics Country now for a brand new name brand computer or wireless laptop. Call right now, and with your paid purchase, you'll also get a free 20-inch LCD TV and a free color printer. Call Tronics Country right now at 1-800-990-2258. 1-800-990-2258. That's 1-800-990-2258.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back. Jalene Jordan is with me. We have some email at calltalkyes@yahoo.com.
We've been called to task by Patrick. And
where is he from?
Mount Clemens.
Okay.
He says, you seem to talk about protests every week, yet I never hear you mention our local protest every Monday night at 9 and Woodward. Why don't you both put up? Or shut up, as they say, and start plugging this protest and or actually show up for once. We talk about that protest all the time.
I've got to say that, Patrick. It's true.
And also, and we've been.
Yeah.
I've been on it about three occasions since I moved back.
I've been there more than that. And so it's, what time is it? Is it 4:45?
Yeah.
4:45 in the corner
Woodward
and Nine Mile Road, right near the Ferndale Post Office. And what was I? Oh, yeah, you can go to my website, Peter Werby, W-E-R. R-B-E, peterwerby.com. Go in the left column and click on it there, and it will take you to the calendar and also list that as one of the many vigils that are continue around Detroit. All right, we want to get to our calls, but maybe we should just do our religious segment first.
You cannot petition the Lord with
okay, the Pope says condoms make the AIDS problem worse.
Dumbass.
I can't believe that.
Yeah, he was in Cameroon.
Well, yeah, I can. Sorry.
He said condoms are not the answer to the AIDS epidemic in Africa and can make the problem worse, setting off criticism Tuesday, do you think, as he began a week-long trip to the continent where some 22 million people are living with HIV. Yeah. His first statement on the issue that divided even Catholic clergy working with AIDS patients. And let's see, the Pope told reporters, you can't resolve it with the distribution of condoms. On the contrary, it increases the problem. I don't know how it does. He doesn't explain that. The Catholic Church rejects the use of condoms as part of its overall teaching against artificial conception, and senior Vatican officials have advocated fidelity in marriage and abstinence from premarital sex as key weapons in the fight against AIDS.
Don't you understand, people? That doesn't work.
Yeah. Well, I guess it just doesn't work, does it? I mean, telling people that that they just shouldn't do it.
Yeah.
Except under these controlled circumstances. Just doesn't work at all.
Yeah. Get with the times.
Now, this really struck me. We are going on with religion here. Terminally ill cancer patients who drew comfort from religion were far more likely to seek aggressive, life-prolonging care in the week before they died than were less religious patients, and far more likely to want doctors to do everything possible to keep them alive, according to a study that's appearing in the Journal of the American Medical Association.
You would think that we heathens would be a little more worried.
Whoa, what's going to happen? Either it's a big nothing, or burn
in hellfire.
Yeah, yeah. The patients who were devout were three times as likely as less religious ones to be put on a mechanical ventilator to maintain breathing during the last week of life. And there's a lot you can make what you want of that. I make of it what Jolene does, and that is, if you think you're going to go sit at the feet of the Lord, why do you even? I mean, you should welcome.
You shouldn't
that.
Be worried.
Yeah, get rid of
the pearly gates. Come on.
Shed the mortal coil and get rid of the travail of life. I mean, a lot of religions, you want to get off of the wheel of life. In fact, the hell is getting reincarnated and have to do it again, right?
I don't know. I think I'd be okay with that.
But here, that's not what. What is it in? It must be in Hindu. Aggressive life prolonging care comes at a cost, however, in terms of both dollars and human suffering. Medicare, the government's health plan for the elderly, spends about one third of its budget on people who are in the last year of life, and much of that on patients at the very end of life. Aggressive end of life care can lead to a more painful process of dying, researchers have found, and a greater shock and grief for the families left behind. So it doesn't work too well. But you're right. It's absolutely inexplicable why people that are more religious would want to hang on to life as long as possible. I mean, particularly when you know you're going out. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I can't imagine coming to that real. I mean, intellectually, we all know that. But all of a sudden, there's the yawning maw of either big nothing or heaven or hell. And maybe that's it. Right?
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, some people in other religions, they're really fascinated by Christianity because it's like a tightrope. One false slip, boom, you're condemned for eternity to hell.
Not very forgiving.
I thought this God was a God of love. He wouldn't do that.
Thank you.
I'm convinced that if Jesus died for our sins, he died for all of our sins, right?
Yeah.
Even the heathens, the pagans, the atheists, whoever, he did it all.
We're good.
Yeah. What does Patti Smith sing on Gloria? You know that song?
I do.
Jesus died for my sins.
I saw her do it live.
Really, but not for mine. Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, I was going to read this, but there's too many. We haven't even taken one call, have we?
It is 11:40. This is a call-in talk show.
Yeah, you wouldn't know it, though. We've been blabbing. Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan with you.
You have a mouse in your pocket?
Yes, at 313-298-WRIF. And let's see here. Let's do this by how long people have been waiting. Here's Phil in Auburn Hills. Phil, let's hear from you. What's happening? You're on the air. Hey, Phil. Let me see. Did I do it? This is the one. I haven't done it in so long. I didn't even press his phone button.
It's a bad sign, Peter.
Phil, talk to me. How come you won't answer me? All right. Wait, I'm sorry. All right. Phil, hi.
Hey, how you doing tonight?
Hi, you're on
the
air.
Hey, Phil.
Sorry. Yeah, go ahead.
Just calling. It's just to bring up a point. And every time you mention the financial crisis, you label it a Republican problem or brought on by issues by Republicans, but it really started back in the Clinton administration in 99 with the Financial Modernization Act that went through, and that was voted 92-8 in favor.
Well, and he signed it. Yeah, you're right. I mean, I did say that there was.
I don't think it started there.
Yeah, it started. This essentially is Reaganomics. This were these are all Republican bills. Every one of these ones that hammered the economy were.
Well, I mean, if you want,
were
exactly.
Well, let me finish. Were Republican bills that Clinton signed, and I hold him responsible for it. So the Democrats have a role, and in that Modernization Act, and also the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act, all of that stuff. Without going into the details, that was one of the key ones. I mean, that was a key Republican piece of legislation, and that is something that Clinton should have just dug his heels in and said, no, I'm not signing that, because that is going to create the kind of situation that I could imagine happening in a few years, which has.
Well, there's very little opposition, period. So I don't think Clinton had any interest at all. And in fact, you know, his Treasury guy, Robert Rubin and Larry Summers were the ones that were really pushing that.
Yeah, the fact that they have Larry Summers in there now, again, one of the architects of all of this. Yeah, I mean, they were all in it. I mean, it's a huge racket. I would say, you know, if we had to really have it as a derby, as a horse race, I'd say the Republicans are way out in front, but that doesn't absolve the Democrats for the role that they play. I mean, if they are supposed to be, you know, the party of the working people, the defenders of the middle class, and all the Republicans do is defend the evil rich people, let them act out their role. In fact, they don't.
Yeah, and the fact that that passed, it was really an effort of probably, you know, at least $500 million in lobbying fund by Wall Street banks. And
sure.
If you look at the guys that are going to be cleaning up the mess right now, Beisler and Summers are far too embedded in Wall Street to have any objective opinion.
Yeah, I agree. You know, well, they have the perspective, even if this will work, and not send us down, completely down the drain, they're the guys that see the paradigm that is the model of how this economy should operate is exactly how it did a few years ago. Because to them, the Clinton years were the dream years. And sure, there was some prosperity that wasn't shared by everybody, and the way the wealth that was produced wasn't shared very equitably. But it also, I think, is that you could be getting at, Phil, that the 90s set the stage for what's happened now with both the Republicans and the Democrats sharing in the responsibility. And that's what, like the Larry Summers see as a way to get us back on track.
That's true. And then the other point I'd like to make is the one person that's kind of making sense in this whole thing is Paul Volcker's, and no one listens to him, and he wants to repeal a lot of the things that went in 99, reinstate. I don't know if it's necessarily reinstating Glass-Steagall, but find a way to separate banks that, you know, the state and the risky assets, because part of the whole reason for the run-up in all the Wall Street activity, M&A and the markets and commodities, everything like that, was the fact that, you know, a Citibank could take deposits that we put in there that we want to have absolute safety, but they use that to speculate on oil. So oil goes up to $1.50, $150 a barrel, and they put our money at risk. And there's got to be a way to separate the two.
Well, I agree, but it really takes a commitment to reconfiguring the whole financial system, and I don't think the will is there. I mean, if there are people, for instance, if Barack Obama, who's an incredibly brilliant man and understands the totality of the system, unlike his predecessor who understood none of it, who was just kind of acting out his rich boy script, he doesn't. I'm sure none of them believe that the political will is there in Washington to make these enormous alterations that would almost amount to a financial revolution. The American people would be fine. I mean, if we said, look, we're going to create a system that isn't based on making the wealthiest the highest return on their investment, but rather securing our homes, securing our jobs, securing our pensions, and here's the way we're going to do it. Everybody'd say, I'm on board. I mean, I would.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you, Phil. You brought up some good points, and I don't mean ever to, I always get put in this position. To my Democratic, to my stalwart Democratic Party friends, I'm always letting them have it.
Right.
I'm saying, come on, man. Look where these guys are. And most people, I think you got to understand that the Republicans are the worst of, how do you say that? The worst of the two evils.
Yeah.
Yeah, by a long shot.
We got an email, James in Kenosha, and he said a couple of things. And one is AIG claims they must pay out these bonuses because they can't break a pre-existing contract.
Contractual obligation.
And he said, well, what about auto workers in Detroit? Have they ever experienced a broken contract? Or should I ask if auto workers have ever had a contract honored from start to finish?
Yeah, that's true. And they're called retention bonuses too. Why do they want to retain these losers that created this mess at AIG in the first place? And secondly, it didn't retain a lot of them. So,
oh.
And they're always saying they have to have these salaries. You know, I know a lot of people who are pretty bright. If you, instead of offering them $3 million or $30 million a year, you say, I'm going to give you $300,000, they'd be
out the door.
They'd be in the door in this case.
Oh, I see.
You know what I mean? In other words, if they started saying, hey, wait, this job, instead of paying the millions and tens of millions of
dollars,
we're
going to take you down to
a few hundred thousand, yeah, they'd get confident people. This is interesting. A former Bush White House aide was sentenced to 2.5 years in prison Wednesday for stealing $600,000, I love this, from a government-funded program that promotes democracy in Cuba.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh.
Felipe Sixto apologized for stealing from the Center for a Free Cuba, telling U.S. District Judge Reggie Walton that in addition to his own greed and selfishness, quote, he wanted to provide a lifestyle for my family I could not afford. Walton sentenced him to 30 months in prison, blah, 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 blah. Walton also criticized Sixto for accepting a job in the White House, knowing that he'd been stealing from the center, an independent institution that receives millions of dollars in USAID funds for rent, travel, equipment such as shortwave radios and laptops. You know, this is another deal. Could you imagine if there was a country spending millions of dollars to overthrow the United... Oh, yeah. I think it's called Al-Qaeda.
Right.
Yeah? You know,
exactly.
Right?
Oh,
yeah.
Boy.
I mean, what in the world is a country doing? I mean, in fact, this must be even illegal under international law and the UN Charter. I mean, there's a lot that needs to be changed in Cuba. As many of you know, I've been there a couple times and know enough about it to know that, you don't want one-man rule in government. And if I was a Cuban, I'd probably be in plenty of trouble. I mean, there's a lot to be said for the country, but overthrowing it, so what? It would become like Democratic Mexico. That's a wonderful place, isn't it? Or how about Democratic Colombia or Democratic Haiti? Well, I think these people are better off in the short run, at least, with things as they are, and that these millions of dollars that in USAID funds that go for rent, travel, and equipment, such as shortwave radios and laptops, which turns out just to be a racket, because what's it called? The Center for a Free Cuba. It's a racket. I mean, maybe they'll have some hand in eventually overthrowing, but the United States pays funds to overthrow governments all over the world. In fact, it has a long history, particularly in the 20th century, in the early part of it, but even in the latter part of it. Just paying millions and millions of dollars trying to get regimes in, a regime change, right? I mean, what would we think of some other country? What if China was financing regime change in the U.S. to get a communist, capitalist country like they have?
Wouldn't go over so well, would it?
No, but we need that money here. We don't need to be giving it to Felipe here to blow, right?
Right.
All right, let's take some more calls. Here's Lars from Madison Heights. Lars, thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. Hi, you're on the air.
Okay.
Hey, whoa, okay.
DC protest this weekend.
What? You went? Oh, you went to Washington?
Yes.
For the anti-war protest?
Yeah, I heard that they're from... The people who are with me there, that they think there's about 3,000 protesters there.
3,000.
3,000. Wow, that's a fallback from like 500,000 that usually shows up from there.
Oh, yeah, it was buses on a Saturday, and a lot of the places we stopped at after the Pentagon were basically closed or empty on Saturdays. Like, we went to Lockheed Martin, General Dynamics, Boeing, and KBR, and dropped off cardboard boxes with national flags taped to them to represent people and countries that have been bombed by the United States.
Wow.
Wow. You know what?
Your connection's horrible,
yeah,
Lars.
You've been on hold all this time on your cell phone? Are you driving?
And now we can't hear him at all.
No, he dropped. Oh, Dave.
Wow, they
went
to...
Sorry about that.
It sounds like quite the action there.
Yeah. Let's see. Oh, yeah. In fact, this is what the one emailer told us about. 6 years ago today, this was sent on March 19th, the Bush administration launched the shock and awe assault on Iraq, thus beginning what has turned into one of the longest and most costly military engagements in U.S. history. We don't think about that. You know, the Second World War, well, let's go to the First World War, went from where? I think like October... Well, did it just go for like a year and a little over a year, I think,
wow.
World War One. I mean, it wasn't 2 years even. It was 1917, 1918. World War Two essentially went from 1942 to, June or so of 1945. So it's about, 3.5 years or something like that. This has gone on for 6 years. And this is from United for Peace and Justice, unitedforpeace.org. And they say, we know what the war and occupation in Iraq has cost. More than 1 million Iraqis killed, 5 million Iraqis displaced from their homes, over 4,000 U.S. service people killed and tens of thousands wounded, more than $600 billion of our tax dollars spent. Well, boy, we could, I mean, they're talking...
What can we do with that?
They're talking about $1 trillion in some of these bailouts, but $600 billion would have gone a long way towards one of this. One of the oldest civilizations on earth brought to ruin. 6 years, long years of a war that never should have happened, a war based on lies and corporate greed, and, yeah.
'Cause it's all about the price of oil. It's all about the price of oil.
That's our friend Billy Bragg, the English singer-songwriter. You can go to Billy Bragg, BRAGG.com, I think maybe .org, but probably .com. But actually, it's not about the price of oil. It's about control of oil. That's what it's really all about. But United for Peace and Justice is organizing a mobilization in New York City on April 4th. If you can get there, do it, please. U.S. oil companies are now going to be able to own, this is Iraqi law, own more than 50% stock in companies that operate in Iraq. Previously, that's what the United States did in, and how soon we forget. What was the guy who was Paul Bremer? Remember he was?
Oh, yeah.
He was the Galtalir of Iraq. He just came in there and started promulgating laws, and one of them was he repealed the section of the Iraqi constitution that said no profits from oil could go out of the country. So now you can. So that so you have all this oil investment. And how is it that they could pump all this oil before and now they can't and they need U.S. and other foreign companies in there? Well, because the United States destroyed the infrastructure. And so when it looks good, you say, things are getting peaceful there. Well, sure. I mean, after the whole damn place was destroyed. All right, let's take another call. Some open lines for you at 313-298-WRIF. It's Eric and Ypsilanti. Eric, thanks for joining me. And Jolene, you are on the air.
Good morning. I mean, good evening, Peter and Jolene.
Well, welcome.
Hello. Almost morning.
Almost
here.
Morning.
Yeah. I wanted to say a couple of things.
You know,
I have heard that President Obama and John McCain had received some money from AIG for their campaign.
And that wouldn't surprise me. You know what? I'm looking at the client. You've been on it a long time. Hold on. I'm not hanging up on you. I got to do some spots. I'll be right back to you.
Got to get those commercials in before midnight.
Yeah. This hour is sponsored by AI. No, I'm only kidding. We'll be right back. Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan, 313-298-WRIF.
This is Night Call on 101-WRIF. Peter will be right back with more of your calls right after this.
The future is here. We do not need to be afraid anymore.
From your iPhone 3G, download the free WRIF app in the iTunes Store. It gives you one-touch access to WRIF streaming live wherever you are. Get more details at WRIF.com.
The riff. Money, money, money. How's your money today compared to this time last year? I'll bet your IRA, 401k, and brokerage accounts are down big. 30, 40, even 50%. And some people think it's going to get worse. You can't retire yet, but you can find a broker to help you. The Secure Investors Group. They'll get you into fixed, secure investments that are guaranteed to grow regardless of the economy. Right now, the Secure Investors Group is offering a free analysis and consultation on your current portfolio. Just call 248-335-6200. Don't wait for the market to come back. Be proactive and guarantee your portfolio growth in 2009. Secure Investors Group has strategies to stop the bleeding right away. Call 248-335-6200. If you're down 50% like many folks, your account needs to gain 100% to be even. Will that happen with your current asset management? Fix it now by calling Secure Investors Group, 248-335-6200. That's 248-335-6200.
The thrill of the hunt, the excitement of the chase, the elation of victory, the satisfaction of saving.
Right now, you can bid on the items you want and name the price you want at the Motor City Steals and Deals online spring auction. All items have a minimum value of $500. The spring auction lasts for 1 week only. Log on to stealsanddeals.com for details. Remember, you only have until 5 p.m. March 23rd to snare your savings.
Let the bidding begin!
It's the Motor City Steals and Deals spring auction, happening now.
How long have I been telling you about Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury? I've driven a lot of their cars, and when I'm there, I always feel confident. Confident that the dealership is forthright, they're reliable, and they're there to support their customers' needs. Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury wants to invite you to check out the all-new Mercury Milan. It's a sophisticated sedan with abundant standard and available features, like stylish satin aluminum accents, advanced technology features, which include a voice-activated DVD-based navigation system, and the hands-free control of the sync system. And thanks to a five-star frontal crash test rating, the all-new 2009 Mercury Milan shows its protective side as well. Right now, through March 31st, renewal customers can lease an all-new 2009 Mercury Milan for 39 months for only $199 per month with $2,150 down, including security deposit plus tax, title, plates, and approved credit. See dealer for details. Discover the Demmer difference today. Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury on Michigan Avenue, just east of Oakwood Boulevard, or visit Demmer.com.
When was the last time someone offered you a second chance to save thousands of dollars? If you owe the IRS or state at least $15,000, American Tax Relief is offering you a second chance to eliminate up to 85% of your delinquent taxes. Thousands of honest, hardworking Americans have turned to American Tax Relief for the help they need. Look, your tax problem isn't going to go away. In fact, it's only going to get worse unless you get help. Call 1-800-493-8159. Now you have qualified help in dealing with the IRS. This is the second chance you never had before to save up to 85% on the taxes you owe. Get the second chance you deserve and save up to 85% on your delinquent taxes. Call American Tax Relief for a free consultation to see how much money they can save you. Call 1-800-493-8159. Call right now for your second chance. 1-800-493-8159. That's 1-800-493-8159.
Please stay tuned to the following public announcement. The government and private banks are liquidating houses now. These houses have been foreclosed, confiscated, or repossessed, and will be sold. Homes may be sold for very little money down. To learn how to receive a free list of foreclosures, call 800-354-8211. All listeners whose last name begins with the letter A through N are allowed to start calling now. Listeners whose last name begins with O through Z can begin calling tomorrow, 9 a.m. Every house must be sold. The government and banks are very motivated to sell these homes quickly, so listings may not always remain available in all areas. So act now. I repeat, this is a public announcement. All listeners whose last name begins with the letter A through N can start calling now. Listeners whose last name begins with O through Z can begin calling tomorrow, 9 a.m. Call CRN's national toll-free hotline to learn how to receive your free foreclosure list at 800-354-8211. That's 800-354-8211.
Did you know the tap water in your home may be hazardous? Not to your health, but to your appliances and your wallet. Your home's hard water creates pipe clogging lawn scale, and that can shorten the life of your water heater, ruin your dishwasher, and break down your washing machine. Lime scale deposits block the heating element, which costs you up to 25% more. That's an extra $1,200 a year in energy and wear. But you can remove lime scale without chemicals, magnets, or salts. It's easy with HydraCare, the patented device used worldwide. See for yourself at bestsoftwater.com. You simply clip HydraCare to your main water pipe. HydraCare removes and prevents lime scale buildup in your entire plumbing system. Guaranteed. If your home has hard water, extend the life of your appliances and save money with HydraCare. Just go to bestsoftwater.com. Lower your energy costs. Visit bestsoftwater.com. That's bestsoftwater.com.
101 WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Kevin Jaleen, you're listening to Night Call, the Rift award-winning talk show on 101 WRIF.
All right, we're back with our second hour of WRIF's Night Call. Peter Werby, Jalene Jordan, 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
And we have some open lines for you. This, I don't know why this is a short and not a big headline. The U.S. Postal Service said on Friday it's closing 6 of its 80 district offices. In addition, administrative staff positions at district level nationwide are being reduced by 15%, and nearly 150,000 employees nationwide been given opportunities to take an early retirement. Well, which means, we were talking earlier about these weekly vigils, these anti-war vigils at Woodward and Nine Mile Road in Ferndale, and that's just a little teeny block, one of those small blocks from the Ferndale Post Office. I hope none of them are listening, because they're really nice people, but we call it the Post Office from Hell.
Because oh, I know.
There's nobody there.
It's not good.
Yeah, there's like 15 people in line, and I've been in there sometimes, and there's nobody behind the counter.
Yeah, it's not good.
Yeah, no, it's terrible. And they're probably going to stop like Saturday service. You know, one thing that's interesting, the federal employees are heavily unionized and heavily Democratic, and so I'm sort of surprised surprised the Obama administration is doing that.
Hey, we were talking about AIG and the donations?
Contributions? Oh, yeah, right. No. Oh, wait a minute. Yeah, I'm sorry. We've got Eric on the line. I'm sorry, Eric. That's one of the 130 reasons that Jalene Jordan is here. Yeah, so you were saying that you heard that AIG gave contributions to both McCain and to Obama, which would not surprise me.
And not only that, Senator Chris Dodd and Congressman Barney Frank received donations from AIG, too.
Yeah. It looks like Obama collected $130,000 in 2008 and McCain $60,000.
Wow. So
Obama's
more...
more evil in this case.
Well, you know what it is? I would bet that all these corporate funds shifted to the Democratic Party. They knew where, they didn't need a weatherman to know which way the wind was blowing.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And so are they beholden to them? Well, I think, Eric, you've probably heard the phrase, he who pays the piper calls the tune, right?
Right. And Obama said in 60 Minutes that he doesn't believe in punishing them companies that get bonuses.
Here's one thing that's interesting. There is a number of things in the Constitution that may have made this bill. I wonder whether Obama will sign this, that, you know, they just passed this bill in the House that said that there's going to be 90% tax. I'm always advocating... I'm always advocating 90% tax on, like, say, all wealth over $5 million or income over $5 million. And they've gone and done it on these bonuses. But there's a couple of things. And one is what's called a bill of attainder, which is in the Constitution that says, you know, you can't single out a group of people. You couldn't say, you know, like redheaded people got to pay more taxes or, Anabaptists have to pay more money. And that was done a lot in European countries, and that's one of the reasons it's in the Constitution to keep it fair. And the other thing is ex post facto laws, which means you can't pass laws on people to essentially criminalize or penalize people for something that happened in the past. So that law, which we're all saying, yeah, you know, grab it, get it back from them, which I am all for. But there may be some constitutional problems with that. All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate your
call.
Great
thing to bring up. Yeah.
And the only time that's going to change is that when we get all corporate money 100% completely out of politics. And what would you...
good luck.
Yeah. I mean, the AIG, before all this comes down, goes to the Obama campaign and says, we want to give you $100,000+. When he's, no, I won't give it to those awful Republicans. So, there's so much spent on these campaigns, which is also nuts as well. You almost ought to take all money out of it. Just have a few weeks of campaigning, have a lot of national debate or presentations. You don't even necessarily have to have debates. You could have the presidential candidate from each party and some way to even get the third party candidates and the smaller candidates, because you know what? I mean, Barack Obama is a pretty impressive candidate and what have you. But I've said this before. I think that if, in terms of the aspirations and the politics of the American people, that probably the contest should have been Ron Paul for the Republicans and Dennis Kucinich for the Democrats, because Dennis Kucinich is on the left. He's not in the center like Obama is, and it's kind of odd. I don't know where really the, I mean, I know where Ron Paul places himself, but, you know, the McCain is old line, you know, Washington insider, usually rightist, somewhat center rightist, and what have you. But Ron Paul has a lot of the aspects of him that that American people like. You know, get out of my life. He doesn't want drug laws. He wants to bring all the troops home, dismantle all the bases. He's for a number of things. And then he's socially conservative on a number of things, which reflects where some people are at. So if you're going to keep the money, if you're going to keep the big money in the system, it's just going to rotate. You're going to have really, really awful bad Republican administrations like Reagan and Nixon and Bush, and then you're going to have not so bad ones like Clinton and Obama. But I mean, they're going to have enough to them that never really changes reality, that this is just kind of a merry-go-round. It's kind of like these Latin American countries, the way, for instance, Venezuela used to be. You'd have kind of a liberal party, then a conservative party, then a liberal party, then a conservative party. Mm-hmm. And people would think, is that you or me?
I'm not sure.
Okay. All right. That, friends, you probably know, is feedback. All right, let's...
it's not pleasant.
Yeah, we have open lines, 313-298-WRIF. Here is Jeff. Hi, Jeff. You're on the air.
Hey, Jeff. Peter.
Yeah, hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
Hey, I just wanted to call, and I watched a movie a couple weeks ago. I talked to you a couple weeks ago about smoke and going cold turkey. It ain't working so well. But the thing is, I called about a movie called... Taxi from the Dark Side, about Abu Ghraib. Have you guys seen that?
No, but...
What's it called?
Taxi from the Dark Side.
Mm. Oh, man. If you're not pissed at the Bush administration now, after you watch this movie, you will be. It infuriated me. I mean, they tortured this guy, and it was pretty brutal.
At Abu Ghraib in the American facility in Iraq, right? Prison facility.
Well, I think it was in Cuba, actually.
Well, they were doing massive tortures. No, I'm sorry, they weren't doing massive tortures. They were doing specific tortures that were enough under U.S. law to lock up the officials, including Cheney, who directed these. They would do Mark Danner. Just look up that name, Mark Danner, D-A-N-N-E-R, and he has a recent article in the New York Times that they got this whole report from what was going on, and they would question these guys, and then they would say, well, he's not saying anything, and they would call Washington, and they would get permission directly from, and I don't want to inaccurately report this, but someone maybe as high as Cheney, maybe as high as Rumsfeld, and they'd say, yes. Waterboard him. Or they would say, we want to strip him naked and leave him in a freezing cold room.
Oh, unreal.
And the individual interrogators didn't have the call on it. It was right in from Washington. And it didn't even provide the information that they wanted. They actually thought, and I don't have the names in front of me, I can't remember I can't remember. But they said the guy, by the time they got done with him, was a total whack job and was admitting to everything. And just making up stuff left and right.
No, well, you know, if you torture anybody, they'll say what you want to hear, you know. And the thing is, this guy was totally innocent. He was a taxi driver. That's where he got the taxi from the Dark Side. And he was innocent, and they beat him. I think they beat, like, they hit him, like, behind his ankles or whatever, or behind. And, I mean, he bled, internally bled to death. And if you watch it, it's a good movie. It fell in fury, you know. I mean, it was pretty.
You know what, Jeff? I am not going to watch it.
I don't think I can take it.
Like that. And, I mean, I think good numbers of American people that, you know, the small percentage of people left that still think all of that is worked well and that Bush was a good president. I guess all those people in Texas, that they ought to watch it. And I appreciate that you want to, because in many ways it gives you more information, confirms the kind of belief about how awful.
Yeah, and I'm glad that there is a movie made about it general, you know.
And just what an assault. I mean, people that, these Republicans always talking about the Constitution, and what an assault. Bush and that gang of war criminals, and that's what was practiced there, war criminals. When you do that to people, that is a war crime. All right, Jeff, thank you very much. I appreciate your call. Good talking to you.
Yeah.
Oh, Sorry. Here, many detainees locked up at Guantanamo in Cuba were innocent men swept up by U.S. forces, unable to distinguish enemies from non-combatants.
Sound familiar? We were just talking about
now,
this.
What left-wing commie put that out there? This was a former Bush administration official, and And there are still innocent people there, said Lawrence B. Wilkerson, a Republican who was chief of staff to then Secretary of State Colin Powell. Some have been there 6 or 7 years, and this is why this is the importance of law, of international law, of our Constitution, of U.S. statutes. There was something I don't know why I'm not remembering things. Actually, I got up so early. I traveled I was out east this weekend, and I'm all down with this, but I don't think everything's firing, so I can't remember the year. But there's something called the Magna Carta, which is one of those things often you hear in high school and is the basis of British American law and what have you, Anglo American law. But what it essentially said, all these knights and dukes and all that got together, and they wrote this document that said that limited the absolute right of the executive to do things to people, to confiscate their property, this thing, habeas corpus. You just couldn't put people in jail and keep them away forever. You couldn't torture people. Now, you people might say, well, didn't the English kings do that for a very long time? They did. They did, but the founding fathers were like so aware of the Magna Carta that they instituted those in the foundation document of this society called the American Constitution, and added to it by the Bill of Rights, so the amendments to the Constitution, and all of it in there about the right of free speech and to express oneself, to challenge the ruler, no cruel and unusual punishment, the speedy trial, all that stuff I mentioned earlier about Bill of Attainder, all of that based right in the Magna Carta. And it was like the, for all its flaws, the fact that it allowed slavery and gave power to the southern states to count slaves as 3/5 of a person, this was an amazing document that actually institutionalized the rights of the people. I mean, it's been abrogated and violated and assaulted so many times in American history. I mean, officials in this country, they're working in concert with the businesses and with their attempts to repress people and exploit people would take 10 shows to just talk about them all. But, we haven't even mentioned Howard Zinn. Go to Zinn, pick up his People's History of the United States. Look at some of the stuff from the 1890s, all the repression around World War One. I mean, the Woodrow Wilson administration, in terms of its repression of civil liberties and the right to organize and what have you, it made George Bush look like an ACLU supporter.
Wow, yeah. That's amazing.
It's that bad, yeah. But so that even out of the mouths of Republicans, that many at this torture facility, this concentration camp, essentially, and that's what it concentrates these people and then acts on them, separate from any kind of rights or judicial review. All right, let's go on. Still open line, 313-298-WRIF. Here's Dan in Ann Arbor. Dan, it's Peter and Jalene. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Peter. How's it going?
It's going good.
All right. I wanted to ask you if you've seen the Obama deception. That it's been it's kind of a newer internet movie that's been making its way around.
No.
I've heard about it.
Yeah.
Have you seen it?
Yeah, I watched it in two sittings, but it really confirms a lot of what I believe from the last couple of elections. And while I'm a younger guy, I'm only 24, but it really does, it elaborated more on what I didn't know about the Federal Reserve and how the people with the money have been pulling the strings for a long time. And it just, it really confirms a lot of why I haven't voted in the last two elections, because it's not Republicans versus Democrats. It's really they're all being manipulated. They're not against each other. It's just the money that's controlling everything.
Well,
it doesn't matter who's in power.
I mean, it was a bunch of rich white guys that set up this country in the first place. I mean, that's that's nothing new, and they've done everything possible to repress ordinary people, to keep their level of exploitation as high as possible. I mean, including the keeping of slaves, and finally when it became impractical, and they've we had kill a few hundred thousand Americans on both sides in order to, you know, that the failed attempt to sustain slavery and the right to organize ordinary people and to manipulate the economy in different ways. I mean, you know, the Federal Reserve System was set up to stop the frequent collapses of the system. I mean, obviously it didn't work. I mean, because you had continuing collapses, and yeah, they're agreed on the fundamentals of the way this the system works. The elites run everything. They make the major economic and political decisions, and then you know, we get to vote for you know, between them. And do I think one group of them is better than the other? Or let me put it another way. Do I think one group of them is, in fact, much worse than the other? Yeah, and that's the Republicans. They're much worse, and increasingly so, because they at least used to have, what it used to be is that there used to be Republicans that were very right-wing, and then you had some moderates, like you had a governor here in Michigan called Milliken. You had the governor of New York, Rockefeller, for whatever. I mean, not that he was the greatest in the world. And so, and then, so you had conservatives and what they called liberal Republicans. And then the Democrats, you had very liberal Democrats, and then you had these right-wing racist senators from the South. You know, I'm talking 50, 60 years ago. But now, actually, there's been quite a bit of realignment. So you only have far right-wing, with a few very, very minor exceptions, far right-wing whack job Republicans, and in the Democrats are mostly moderate to sort of tepid liberals. But I mean, I was saying that earlier. I mean, money runs things. And if there's going to be authentic democracy or authentic representative republic, we can't let the money interests call the tune. But I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure where the ideas can... I haven't seen the film, but where that takes us. Because there's been all this right-wing agitation against these bailouts and Obama. But what's their solution? They don't have one, do they?
No, you say that Republicans are worse. They're maybe more openly worse, but you got a guy like Obama in office right now who's basically a commissioned salesman. He's there to gain approval rating and gain the public's trust, and he's doing it successfully because people don't really know what his agendas are.
What's his agenda?
And we're starting to see all those.
What's his agenda?
Well,
what's the movie say?
He's supporting the same people that support everyone in the campaign, the people with the money.
Well,
and he's supporting their.
We knew that.
But that's the nature of the system. It's based around finance. It's based around production. It's based around manic production and you know, and our role is to manically consume, taking out huge amounts of personal debt in order to finance what we really can't afford. So. I mean, that doesn't seem like an, I mean, if you'll excuse me, it doesn't really seem like an enormous revelation that actually what Obama's trying to do is reset the system back up and, to how it's functioned previously, which I don't think is a good idea. I agree with you. But it doesn't seem like any worse. I mean, the agenda seems pretty open to me. Yeah?
Yeah, well, perhaps I've seen the film, the movie that I'm speaking of, and it's about an hour and 53 minutes long, so I don't remember it specifically, but...
Well, a lot of it is that he's a socialist, he's a one-worlder, he probably isn't even a U.S. citizen, he's, you know, he's got some really evil agenda. I mean, he is a man of the system. But, I mean, the idea that, the idea of a McCain and Palin presidency and vice presidency...
Oh. And, shudder.
I mean, everything that Obama has done to reverse these executive orders that are, you know, part of the Bush's allowing the environment to be destroyed and the attack on all any number of environmental and work regulations and all that. I mean, it really was important to have the Republicans defeated. Are we going to move anywhere substantial with the Democrats? No, but if we're depending on them, to do our work for us as people who have our own interests, which are to, like I said earlier, to maintain our families and our communities and our, you know, our health and all of that. I mean, if we're not out there, I mean, people now are pissed off. I mean, why weren't people pissed off 5 years ago? Why weren't they pissed off 10 years ago?
Some of us were.
Well, some of us were, yeah. Now they're saying, oh, the rich are getting everything. Well, the rich always were getting everything. And they were, as long as a little teeny bit of the crumbs were trickling down, it was okay. But now everybody's going, oh, AIG, they're getting bonuses. Well, they were always getting bonuses, and essentially we were always paying for them as well. I don't know. You know what, Dan? I don't think there's great disagreement.
I might watch it just so I can. I know that's going to be brought up on the show, just like the what's the other one? Zeitgeist.
Well, one of the things that I say that I really believe that that videos are not the best way to learn information. It's hard to reflect on things. They're set. People have a conclusion. Well, I mean, in some ways, books are like that too. But you don't. You know, you can't go back and reread. You can't set it down and think about it. It's there to create a single impression. All right. Thank you very much. Thanks for bringing that up. I appreciate that. Speaking of crazy right-wing whack jobs, I shouldn't have said that because I want to read a letter, and I don't mean to put that on Patrick, who writes a letter.
You got a real-life letter?
A letter. I got a letter.
That's crazy.
Man. Patrick from Plymouth, Michigan. If you want to send me or Jalene anything, you can send it to us care of WRIF 1 Radio Plaza. That's 1 Radio Plaza, and it is Ferndale. 48220, or you can go to WRIF.com. Hopefully, it's there somewhere. Or you can go to my website.
It's there.
Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. PeterWerbe.com. Go down the right side, and it'll be contacting Peter. But we were talking last week about, as we have several times, about global warming. And Patrick, who says that, I'll read it. In regard to your radio show last week, people who believe in global warming, the global warming fairy tale, are like the guy who was caught by his wife with another woman, and he says, do you believe me or your lying eyes? I don't know what planet you've been on, but here in Michigan, it's been damn cold these past couple of months. Hey, Patrick, I think it's called...
Winter.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you. And I believe my lying eyes, ears, frozen fingers, and toes, and the biggest liar, the thermometer. Of the many people I know, no one believes in the silly-ass cult of global warming. Why do you? Well, I guess it's because the overwhelming majority, the vast majority of climatologists, let's save that big word till the end of your letter, believe that. I don't know. How do I know? What do I know? I believe them. This is a matter of simple seeing what's happening outside, not, I can't make out this word, not politics. Oh, yeah. I've been listening to you since the early 80s. Wow. And don't always agree with you. I am still a loyal listener. Well, thank you, Patrick. And I have never been able to call in. Well, listen, it's not about temperature.
I just don't know where they're... It's
about climate change.
It is. It's not about how cold it is.
Yeah. And temperature, here's a temperature, although it says temperature rise, which is climate change, may trigger West Antarctic thaw, which could, quite a while, could seas could grow 16 feet. In the meantime, the glaciers are collapsing because of global warming. You know what? Even the people who deny... Here's the debate, Patrick. You're missing the debate. The debate isn't whether there's global warming or not, and that's probably a bad phrase to use. It is, there is climate change, and is the climate change human-made or not? And that may be, even according to some of the people who don't think that humans have much to do with it, that they know there's climate change, and what they say is that this is a natural cycle, or even that there's a shift sort of in the rotation of the planet that's throwing off this...
What? So crazy about that statement, natural? There's nothing natural about the way we live our lives.
Well, I know.
No,
there's some of these people that say that the climate change that's going on is coming from other stuff other than human activity,
right,
like fossil fuel burning, or that it's just a small part of it. But the other people, the vast majority of climatologists say that, in fact, that it is caused by human activity and, fossil fuel burning. So, as I said last week when we talked about this, the smart thing to do would be to clean up stuff anyway. Like the people who are opposing the double span over the Detroit River, that apparently 500 people came out to that meeting last week at in the southwest side.
Oh, really?
Yeah. People really did turn up. And they said, look, we live in this area that already, because of all the truck traffic going over the Ambassador Bridge into Windsor, already we've got this high incident of asthma. So you want to stop pollution.
What is bad about stopping pollution?
Yeah.
Nothing.
At best, it will also stop global warming. But
what about cancer and things
cancer,
like that?
Cancer, all that stuff. And if it's totally wrong, what it will do will stop. It will have an impact on asthma rates, cancer rates.
Health,
whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah, so why people, and here again, Patrick, this is the right wing. This is all right wing conservative driven. Because these people, I don't know what is with them. I mean, I think that they're really whack jobs. They're certifiable. I don't mean,
big time denial going on.
I don't mean you, but I mean the people that are at the core of this movement, like Rush and Sarah Palin and that 14-year-old kid. These are the leaders of the Republican Party, right? Joe the plumber. I mean, that's it. That is absolutely it. Well, listen, we were talking about Windsor. Let's Mark's in Windsor. Hey, you're on the air. Thanks for calling. Thanks for making the program international. Go ahead.
How you doing, gang?
We're doing
great.
That's great. I got a little something to discuss with you. It's a little off topic of what you've been talking about.
No, it's
fine.
It's okay.
I'm an auto worker here in Windsor, and with the way the auto slump is happening and the cutbacks and a lot of time off lately, where we're being laid off and some of our weeks are staggered, where you work a week and you're off 2 weeks, et cetera. Right?
Okay.
Well, my story is like, I purchased a car way back before this even happened, or predict this would happen. Who would know? And I've gone and financed it, and I'm getting in trouble now to the point where I'm spending most of my savings just to pay the car and my mortgage and other things.
And you owe more on your car than it's worth, just like the housing.
Oh, right? Big time.
Yep. That's the next crisis.
Yep, and they're telling me they would rather, instead of me trading it in and getting something cheaper just to have any kind of transportation, they would rather come and repossess it and ruin my credit, perfect credit, and anything else that goes along with it, and,
Well, they repossess it, and they still want their money. Isn't that how it goes, too?
I guess so. I don't even know how it works. I've never had this happen in my life.
It happened to a friend of mine. She got her vehicle repossessed, and they still wanted their money. It's like, well, you got your car.
Yeah, well, that's what it's going to have to boil down to, probably, is all...
No, what they do, excuse me, one second, they auction the car.
Yeah, and whatever
and you owe the difference.
The difference,
well, I mean,
right.
You signed a note. I mean, that's
true.
Where it goes.
But things are happening, what I mean?
And there ought to be some... Well, at one point I said that all debt should be forgiven and start over again.
Let's do it.
I don't know what would happen there.
But you also have to realize that people that are aware of it and they're trying to do something to work with the banks, or instead of letting it just go to the wayside and come and get me, or I'll avoid your payments altogether and cause you big trouble, If people are really making an effort to save their credit or to save, their good credit in the future, don't you think the banks should be a little more lenient and work with you? Through these hard times and recognize them and not just say, we got a troublemaker on our hands here or something,
I do indeed, Mark. I don't know whether
it's that rock in a hard place.
And usually it's not even a matter of, it's a matter of policy, and policy is collect the debts, and sometimes the attempt to collect debts, as you're indicating, winds up screwing them even worse. All right, well, thank you very much. Thank you for bringing that up. Let's see, Roger, who is answering our phones at 313-298-WRIF, said a caller sent along this information, farting cows causes more greenhouse gas than cars. And he puts LOL as well, laughing out. Wow. You could get into a thing. We're raising too much livestock.
Thank you.
As well. How about this? More babies were born in the United States in 2007 than any year in the nation's history, topping the peak during the baby boom 50 years earlier. This is both good and bad news. More than 4.3 million births. So the U.S. population is actually replacing itself, which isn't happening in a lot of European countries. However, the teen birth rate was up for a second year in a row. Births to unwed mothers reached an all-time high of about 40%. Do you think of this 40% of the, I can't do the math, 16 million or no? Never mind, I can't.
I don't know, but that's abstinence only in progress there.
Yeah, there you go. What percentage of these women who were unwed mothers do you think were under 20? Under 20 years of age.
Percentage? Oh, 50?
Now, just 25% of them. In other words, the women who had unwed mothers, three-quarters of these women were 20 years old or older.
Huh. Well, what's going on here?
I don't know. I'm not responsible for any of it.
Me neither.
Dr. Carol Hogue, an Emory University professor of maternal and child health, said, I expect the birth rates will go back down. The lowest birth rates recorded in the United States occurred during the Great Depression, and that was before modern contraception.
Well, that's going down.
You would think, you would think that people would be home a lot more, right?
And home a lot more. Yeah, but when you're poor, you're stressed out, and you're not necessarily feeling...
It could be.
Romantic.
I actually saw, I shouldn't even admit to this, I saw a little bit of Desperate Housewives.
Oh, no.
And there was this role reverse. Man, the things they have on television when I was a kid. This woman in a very scanty little nightie or something like that was attacking this guy. She said, I want it now. Like that.
Really?
She jumped on top of this guy. And the guy's saying, I'm tired. I don't want to do it. And he says, okay, I changed my mind. Let's put a little spice in it. And so he ties her to the bedpost, both her arms. And he says, dear? And she said, yeah. He said, good night.
He needed some rest. He
walked out of the room. Oop, we got to do this. Peter Werby, Jalene Jordan.
On that note.
313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
This is Night Call on 101-WRIF. Peter will be right back with more of your calls right after this.
The future. We do not need to be afraid anymore.
From your iPhone 3G, download the free WRIF app in the iTunes Store. It gives you one-touch access to WRIF streaming live wherever you are. For more details at WRIF.com.
The riff.
If you want to own a new computer but think you can't get credit, listen to this. Now you're approved for a brand new Dell, HP, or other name brand computer for just $29.99 a week. There's no credit check, no hassles, and you won't be turned down. Just call Tronics Country at 1-800-990-2258. If you have a bank account and can afford weekly payments of just $29.99 for 12 months, you're approved for a new computer guaranteed. Even if you have bad credit or no credit, you will not be turned down. And with Tronics Country's program, you can help improve your credit rating. Call Tronics Country now for a brand new name brand computer or wireless laptop. Call right now, and with your paid purchase, you'll also get a free 20-inch LCD TV and a free color printer. Call Tronics Country right now at 1-800-990-2258. 1-800-990-2258. That's 1-800-990-2258.
Is your credit card debt out of control and you don't know what to do? I'm Ted Brower, founder of Debt Settlement USA. Contrary to what you may hear from other advertisers, there's no secret program that can magically eliminate your debt. But Debt Settlement USA does have an answer. We have perhaps the most experienced team in the industry. We've negotiated and settled over $150 million of debt for people just like you. If you have over $12,000 of credit card debt, call right now for a free consultation. Debt Settlement USA built its reputation on one simple fact. We help our clients cut their debt. Find out how we can help you reduce your balances and your monthly payments.
Call Debt Settlement USA at 1-866-560-8877. If you're having trouble with credit card debt, call right now. Call 1-866-560-8877. That's 1-866-560-8877.
If you have acne, here's a phone number you need to call. 1-800-335-4191. Right now, we're looking for the biggest skeptics out there to test out a skin-clearing breakthrough risk-free. If that's you, give us a call. We're going to prove you can make your acne disappear and have clear skin by sending you a 60-day trial of Proactive Solution absolutely risk-free with our compliments. And when you call now, we'll also send you our Green Tea Moisturizer, a featherlight serum that absorbs instantly to deliver deep hydration for free. Call 1-800-335-4191. Our combination therapy system uses prescription-grade acne medicine. It's so effective, it transforms blemishes and bumps into clear, smooth skin and skeptics into believers. You can have beautiful, healthy-looking skin. Put Proactive to the test, and we'll prove it. Get your free soothing green tea moisturizer with your risk-free 60-day trial by calling now. 1-800-335-4191. 1-800-335-4191.
Now, Night Call is back. On 101 WRIF Detroit, here's your host, Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back to our final segment. Jalene Jordan is with me, 313-298-WRIF. At 1 a.m., I'm going to be airing a couple of interviews I recorded earlier this week, one with Loretta Alter. She's a co-producer and co-director of War Made Easy, How Pundits Are Spinning Us to Death. Is that the name of it? Along with Norman Solomon, our pal.
Oh.
Yeah. And also, when I... Let me see. Whoa, man, I did. Oh, that wasn't so long ago. Just a little few months ago. Danny Goldberg, who's one of these rock icons.
Arista Records.
Yeah.
That's what he used to run.
Yeah, pretty incredible. Well, let's see. Although former President George Bush has not been popular in Canada, the country on Tuesday became the venue of his first speech since leaving office.
Isn't that funny? No one around here wants to hear from him. Yeah. We're sick of him.
Calgary, Alberta, the site for the speech, is the home of Canada's...
Because it's all about the prize.
Edmonton Oilers, right?
It's all about the prize.
He was going to say a bad word.
Oh, watch that now.
Yeah. Calgary, Alberta, right? And not Edmonton. And where it's the home of, or the center of Canada's oil and gas industry.
Oh, I thought you were talking about a hockey team.
No. Well, they hockey, eh? The power base of the country's Conservative Party, which counts Prime Minister Stephen Harper among its local members of parliament. Rob Sellerman, spokesman for Bush, said the location for the speaking debut was mainly a coincidence.
Yeah.
One attendee who spoke on the condition of anonymity because of the no press rule, they wouldn't let any press in there, said Bush appeared to speak without a prompter and only occasionally referred to notes.
That's because...
I don't know what you're going to say, but you're right. His remarks contained few surprises, according to the attendee. Perhaps catering to the local audience, Bush spoke out against blah, blah, but he warned against prolonged government intervention in the economy. God, he's the guy that started the bailout.
He wrecked it, and started the bailout, yeah.
He also criticized the financial community, saying Wall Street got drunk and we got the hangover. Who bought the liquor?
Oh, we bought the liquor.
Yeah, well... He bought the liquor.
Oh. Yeah.
Right. But also, you know, they're going to begin groundbreaking, thank you, is scheduled this fall on the George W. Bush Presidential Center, a nonprofit foundation that's trying to raise $300 million in tax-deductible donations for this huge complex on 25 acres of Southern Methodist University in Dallas. Now... $300 million for a 25-acre complex? What are they going to put in this? Is comic books?
Yeah, seriously. It's going to be a big empty...
Yeah.
Like it's going to be as empty as his head.
Maybe it'll be like a bicycle track and maybe just a kind of a sports facility. That'd be cool if other people could use it. But they already have two presidential deals like that, right? Which were? Tick, tick, tick.
Clinton?
No.
What are you talking about?
Who else in Texas?
His dad?
Yeah. That's one. And Lyndon Johnson.
Okay.
So, right. So this article, this column by Gail Collins in the New York Times says, why can't George W. just stick his knickknacks in his father's place? They wouldn't even have to change the name. That's a good idea. In the original George Herbert Walker Bush Presidential Library and Museum at Texas A&M University, where visitors can see, quote, a stunning replica of Barbara's wedding gown. I mean, why would you even want to see the original, but a replica of it, a restored 47 Studebaker, well, you got to have that, samples from the museum's collection of more than 1,200 elephants, and the family speedboat, Fidelity.
Oh, boy.
I don't believe this.
I don't either.
313-298-WRIF. Here's Jeremy in Redford. Hi, Jeremy. You're on the air.
It's Jeremiah, actually.
Jeremiah.
Anyways, okay. Thank you.
You know what? It looked like that, and then, never mind. Right, it is Jeremiah.
It's common. It's very common.
You know what? It even looks like Jeremiah. I don't know why he said Jeremy. Go ahead.
A couple things. First thing is about how you said the nation is run by those with the money, and then I want to elaborate on that as to how they get to decide what's best for us when percentages prove they may lose more monetarily than we do, but yet we still pay the highest price.
Sure.
Now, in that respect, Congress has now put themselves in control of bonuses for companies that receive bailout monies. We all know that. We all know that the bailouts were contractual agreements, which, to my knowledge, hold up in a court of law in this country, between the company and the employee, no matter which company, and without any criteria to base anything against that, we as the people who were paying it had to pay it, unfortunately.
Well, yes and no. I mean, people have made the point that, like, the UAW has been willing to alter these contracts. And essentially going in, I think if they would have said, hey, look, either you got to, you find a way within your corporation to not give anybody any bonuses whatsoever, in fact, have massive pay cuts, or you don't get any money. As simple as that. Let's see who will hold whose feet to the fire. I mean, essentially, I think that the Bush administration and now the Obama administration think that these losers, these incompetents, have the power over the rest of us, and well, they may actually.
You know, when they looked into it, and according to the things I heard, the Bush presidency was told that they wouldn't win in a court of law. It would have been nice to have them ask the companies to go ahead and man up, so to say. You know, like, take it upon yourself, make some concessions, and we'll get together on this and we'll work it out.
That could be, actually.
But when they found that they would lose, they kind of dropped it, and then Congress went ahead and flew it through, paid it out, and then got caught with their pants down.
Yeah.
Now they're struggling to say, well, we didn't fully read it, we didn't understand it, whatnot. And then do we, the people, get to decide the annual performance pay increases for Congress? Now that they've put themselves in a position of determining who's worthy, are they subject to that same stipulation that they're setting up the precedent now?
I don't know. I like the idea, though.
And my last point was just about the cost of gasoline. And my curiosity is that, just off my remembrance, we were at about $140 a barrel not very long ago, and that resulted in $4.20 plus gas prices per gallon. Now, if a $140 barrel cost us $4.20 in a gallon of gasoline, if we don't get the same amount of gasoline out of a $70 barrel, numbers would fluctuate. Otherwise, standard math would dictate that a $70 barrel would produce $2.10 for a gallon.
Okay.
And 50 cents or a $50 barrel should be about approximately a buck and a half.
So we're still getting screwed.
Are we losing gasoline out of a cheaper barrel? Are we yielding more or less? Does that change at all? I mean, how does that really reflect on us? And take that right back to the conversation about asking them for concessions. OPEC has, I know the word monopoly is not applicable, but collectively, they have a monopoly. They get to decide when they're going to increase production and for what reason and cut back whenever, all based on their guesses of how much they need to invest in themselves soon. It seems very confusing.
Well, yeah, I mean, and you're saying that with tongue-in-cheek because it's not confusing, really. We're being ripped off. We're being fleeced. If there really was a free market in oil, we'd probably be paying about, 30 cents a gallon. In fact, you know, in some of these oil-producing countries like Venezuela, Venezuela and Nigeria and Saudi Arabia, you know, it fluctuates anywhere from like 15 cents a gallon to 50 cents a gallon, you know, so they have no problem. I'm actually surprised that Canada doesn't have a very low rate since they're a major oil producer.
I guess my confusion is the understanding of how they get to decide, you know.
Well, I'll tell you, if, I mean, it's sort of the pyramid theory, and at the peak of the pyramid is the elite, and at different points. I mean, there used to be a very, very sharp elite in which the king had absolute power, and it was eroded some by those forces representing the middle class and, you know, the merchants and what have you, with things like the American, the English, and French Revolution. Revolutions, but it's never gotten too far beyond that in terms of actual decision making about the economy, and from that the foreign policy and what have you. So I mean, what we really need is increased democratization. But thank you, Jeremiah. I appreciate you bringing it all up.
Thank you for your time.
All right.
Enjoy your evening.
Okay, you too. Let's see, we got a couple more calls. Maybe time for yours at 313-298-WRIF. Here's John. John, hi, you're on the air. Where are you calling from?
Hey, Pete. I'm calling from Riverview.
Yeah, you're on the air.
All right. Just wanted to touch off on the whole financial situation right now. My wife and I had to file bankruptcy not too long ago. We have a child who has medical needs, and we were basically having to pay for those needs with a credit card.
Uh-huh.
And simply because my HMO and their infinite wisdom felt that his illness wasn't a real illness. And we've been the kind of people that we always pay in, you know, more than our monthly minimum on our cards and such. We try to double it every month if we can. And we got a notice from one of our credit cards explaining to us that because a clause in our contract says that what they feel is financial troubling times, they have the right to raise our interest.
Yeah.
So they raised it from under 10% to 29.9% interest.
Unbelievable.
Well, and when I called them, I said, you know, we've been with you over 15 years. We've never had a late payment. We've always paid more than our minimum. Why would you do this to us? The lady on the phone said, well, sir, if you would read your contract, you would see that we can't. Because if we feel that there's a problem with the economy, we can do it, and we're doing it.
Jeez.
You know, this is another what I call like a pitchfork moment, when the peasants, us, should be out in the streets with our pitchforks in the town square. But it's not that easy. I mean, it's what they're doing is completely legal. How about this for a case in the same way? An elderly person who pays $50,000 into an extended care policy that would give him home care, and then they keep moving it back in terms of when it can kick in, from 3 months to 4 months, and probably the person will die before they get any of the money back.
It's terrible.
And when the guy's wife called, the woman on the phone said, I'm sorry, you should have read the small print.
How cold.
Well, she probably was giving good advice, and probably the small... But here's what I think. There shouldn't be any small print. There shouldn't be any small print for this person. There shouldn't be any small print for you, John.
Yeah.
We should live in a system where people in it are taken care of, and that you shouldn't have to worry about the major institutions fleecing you. But that's what goes on. And until we find a way to work in a manner that we can make that the dominant thrust of this society, rather than the fine print, which brings more and more wealth to the elite, we're going to keep getting screwed.
And well, there's something that's even more frightening is that we didn't want to file bankruptcy. That was a last resort.
I'm sure.
We went to go through one of those credit counseling companies and such, and until a friend of my wife, she got us in touch with a friend of theirs. They had gone through one of those companies, and they were doing, you know, it was one of those ones you see on television where the great saviors and all that. Well, that while they were doing that, going through that company, trying to get their credit taken care of, all of their credit card companies sued them.
Huh.
So you have to be real careful with that, because you could end up in a much worse situation by doing that.
Well, you know what, and I don't know how what I'm just going to say could come about, but I was saying, and I wasn't saying it facetiously, but there has been calls to, for instance, relieve international debts, that some of these countries that have gotten loans from the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, the debt service has done them so much harm, having to pay it back, that they want to just cancel the debt. And I said that maybe we just ought to cancel all debt in this society and start over. Well, if there was a mass movement in this country for that, if all of a sudden there were thousands and tens of thousands of people in the street and trying to elect people to Congress that functioned on that basis and would introduce legislation, and or people just banded together and said, hey, we're not paying, all of a sudden you'd find these credit card companies, these long-term care companies and what have you, say, well, hey, forget about the fine print. Hey,
we'll work with you.
Hey, buddy, can we make a deal? But right now, you've got this gigantic, these gigantic financial concerns that have us by the cojones. Individually, in your case, and this person I was just describing, and collectively, they do as well. Because this whole idea that the bank shouldn't get any money and what have you, they're saying, everything will collapse. And maybe they're right. Maybe everything will collapse if we don't give them all the money. Maybe everything will collapse if we do give them all the money.
Well, I think part of the conditions should have been they get the money and they give everyone a break out here.
Well, there you go. Well, John, I actually had a friend of mine who was in a similar situation. And mm-hmm. I think I said this on the air, and he wrote to me. He said, I'm such a loser. And I
said, man,
you are not a loser. When it's millions of people similarly situated,
yeah.
You're talking about social phenomena that has been either allowed or even engineered.
You're a statistic.
Yeah, yeah.
Really, in this whole big, awful situation. And I hope things improve for you and everyone.
All right, John. Thank you very much. We've got to go home. Appreciate it. Wow. Man, I just...
hate hearing these stories. I have to say, they've said that you couldn't file for bankruptcy anymore. You can. It just cost you $5,000 to do it.
Yeah, one of the things that Clinton signed off on one of these Republican bills that they called it bankruptcy reform. Essentially what it did, it made it harder for people to have their debts relieved. So you have somebody like John, who medical emergencies, just as we've heard this a million times, just totally screw you.
I'm here.
Yeah, you are. Don't yawn into the mic.
Sorry.
Some people with they're listening like on headphones like me can really hear. Do you want to go home, Jillian? Actually,
I could do this for another hour, Peter.
I don't know that you could. Jillian has gets the Trooper of the Evening Award. She actually, I shouldn't even say, but she has an eye injury.
I injured my eye.
And if I was her, I would have stayed home. But
it was a self-injury.
Yeah, well, I don't want to talk about
that. What did you call me? You bonehead?
Come on, I'm trying to put a best bin possible.
No, I injured myself.
Don't even tell them how.
Yeah. I wasn't even drunk.
Yeah, right. She was drinking tea and left the spoon in the cup. No, that's not true.
Come up with your own conclusion.
That's actually an old joke.
You said,
yeah, my aunt went blind from drinking tea. Yeah, she left the spoon in the cup.
That's what I did.
Right. Hey, thanks a lot for listening, and for those of you who called, sorry for those of you who are left on hold.
Thank you to Roger for answering the phone.
Oh, yeah, thank you, Roger. Thank you, Slayer. And, hey, listen to Al Slayer. He's Monday through Friday, midnight
to about 5:30.
All right.
I've
been there, done that. All right. Talk next week. Stay tuned for the interviews.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call right after this.
When we wanted to give you more on the riff, but we ran out of somewhere to put it all, we said, screw it. Let's make a whole nother radio station.
What's that sound?
Riff 2. It's music made for the Motor City and totally commercial free. Log on from anywhere in the world at riff2.com. Everything rocks.
Attention. Hydralyze is currently seeking participants with dark circles and puffy eyes. If you have dark circles or bags around your eyes due to heredity, fatigue, or aging, you are eligible to see results and participate in the Hydralyze trial. Hydralyze was introduced to improve delicate skin around the eyes and now has been shown to eliminate dark circles and bags. It effectively diminishes even dark circles caused by heredity. To participate in the Hydralyze trial and see results risk-free, call 1-800-505-7931. Fragile capillaries around the eye can leak, allowing blood to pool beneath the skin like an ugly bruise. But right now, you can join the thousands of people who have seen their dark circles fade away, watched as bags literally disappeared from view. Participate in the free trial by calling today. If you're serious about getting rid of your dark circles or bags around the eyes, you are eligible to participate and experience results with Hydralyze. Call this number today, 1-800-505-7931. Once more, that's 1-800-505-7931.
Is your credit score holding you back? Are you paying more for everything just because you don't have perfect credit? Well, it's not your fault. Credit card companies are doing everything they can to keep you in debt and never let you escape. But I've got a system that can fix your credit score once and for all. And I'm going to send you a free tape showing you the power of my proven system today.
My credit score is now 758. My wife and I are shouting for joy right now.
Hi, I'm John Commuta, creator of the Transforming Debt into Wealth system. My system doesn't just fix your credit score, it will permanently rebuild your credit status so it can never come back to haunt you again. It works no matter how bad your credit is or how much debt you have.
Our credit score was in the low 600s and now we're at 780.
You can wipe for all. Call right now and I'll rush you my free tape. For your free tape, call 1-800-337-1713. That's 1-800-337-1713. 1-800-337-1713.
You may have seen her on Oprah or The View. We're talking to Lucinda Bassett, founder of the Midwest Center, about a powerful free tape she's giving away to help people discover a way to leave anxiety and depression behind for good. Lucinda, what are some of the symptoms of anxiety?
Worry, fear, depression, insecurity, low self-esteem. I suffered with anxiety and depression for over 20 years. When I was at my lowest point, I was curled up in a ball on my living room sofa, afraid to live and afraid to die.
Wow. So what's the biggest anxiety myth?
I think the most challenging thing about working with people with anxiety and depression is that many of them think they're victims of their emotions. They think they'll always be worrisome, fearful, and depressed.
But that's not true.
There's real drug-free help that has the potential to last a lifetime. Millions of people have called for this wonderful free tape.
Okay, to request your free tape, call 1-800-449-7603. 1-800-449-7603. 1-800-449-7603.
101.1 WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. I wonder how many of you remember reading, probably had to read it in high school, maybe as a freshman in college, George Orwell's 1984. It's always worth rereading. Remember Oceania, the country in which Winston Smith, the protagonist of the book, lived? Oceania was always at war. It was first with one set of belligerents, then with another. And it was endless war. It was one of the characteristics that marked that particular society. I'm sure you can't extend that like to here or anything, but we are entering the seventh year as of the day we're recording this interview with the war and occupation. By now, it's pretty much a solid occupation, more so than an armed conflict, although there are losses, American losses, every single week. Shock and awe began March 19th, 2003. And you may remember in 2007, I interviewed someone who I had who I've had on this broadcast many times before, Norman Solomon, who is the executive director of the Institute for Public Accuracy. He was the narrator. He was he's featured in the film, which we interviewed him about, War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death. And it was narrated by Academy Award winner Sean Penn. So it hasn't lost any of its impact. And I think it's worth reviewing what it looks at, particularly on this anniversary. Joining me is Loretta Alper. She's a producer with Media Education Foundation, and she was also the producer and co-director of War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Kept Spinning Us to Death. You can go to warmadeeasythemovie.org. We're reaching Loretta Alper in her office in Northampton, Massachusetts. So welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Hi, Peter. Thanks for having me.
Any just general sense of things? That's a hell of a question to ask somebody. It's not very specific as we start, but it's an inauspicious anniversary, to say the least. Here we are going into the seventh year of endless war, and you're the piece you produced, the film War Made Easy. It was easy to get into, not so easy to get out of.
That's absolutely the case, isn't it? Unfortunately, I think it's largely becoming a forgotten conflict, and that's the problem going into this seventh anniversary. Is we're not really the media seems to have moved on and shifted their focus. We all know that the economy is the main story right now, and there's talk of shifting some troops into Afghanistan, but really, I think Iraq is becoming the forgotten war.
Well, you know, oftentimes callers to my talk show remind me, they say, this isn't a war, it's an occupation, and these occupations can always expect continuing conflict with people that just aren't at ease with a foreign army in their country. And yet, the war in many ways, what I do read about it, it's being respun as this is turning out to be a success. There's a flourishing democracy, we're told. The markets are open. I saw somewhere a color spread, and people looked like almost like they do in any other country. So, do you agree with that it is being respun as at least somewhat of a victory?
Yeah, I think there is a very powerful effort to re-spin the war as a success. But I would ask, if it's a success, then why are we talking about slowing down the troop withdrawal and the drawdown, and talking about leaving potentially 140,000, there's currently 140,000 troops in Iraq, leaving them there at least until the agreement, the Status of Forces Agreement, runs out in 2011, and then having a force there of anywhere from 30,000 to 50,000 indefinitely in that country. And so I would ask, you know, just how we're defining success in those terms. And I think, in fact, that the mission is becoming incredibly, the goals are defined, if we're even hearing what the goals are, they're defined in very broad and vague terms, and, you know, in terms of stability and security, but I don't think we're really asking questions about what that exactly means. And so, yeah, I think you're right that there is a real effort to redefine the mission to call the surge a success, and certainly violence has decreased, but in terms of the goals of the surge, which were to create stability for a political situation to take place, for political resolve, I would say we're not really seeing that.
Mm-hmm. Loretta Alper, in your film, War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death, it appeared in June of 2007. That's when I interviewed Norman Solomon, who appears prominently in the film. And so I assume it may have even been conceived of in 2005 and probably, you know, put together in 2006. So, and into 2007, when the casualties were increasing, where the war and George W. Bush were at the height of their unpopularity. But looking back on how much things have changed, do you look at the film and is there parts of it that you say, ooh, we were wrong on that one, or boy, we didn't call that one right, or does it all still hold together?
Unfortunately, I think it holds together very. I mean, you know, I'm pleased to think that the larger overview, the long view that the film takes, going back to the Vietnam War, that all of that still really rings true. And in terms of the current situation, I don't think we got anything wrong. I think what we're seeing is the problems of trying to end a war that really shouldn't have been begun in the first place.
Well, I think that's one of the keys, and to see this as a success, I mean, it's almost to say, boy, that person's so wonderful, he stopped slapping me. Maybe can you just review quickly, because I said to you before the show that oftentimes historic memory among Americans is about as short as, I don't know what. I mean, George W. Bush, you say that and people almost scratch their heads. It's like saying Monica Lewinsky or something like that. I mean, we seem to have traveled so far since the Iraq War was deep in our consciousness every day. Review to us the events of 2003 and the lead up to that, if you would.
Well, we started to after 9/11 and the bombing and invasion of Afghanistan. We started to really quickly in the even late fall of 2001, and then beginning in 2002, start to hear talk of the threat that Iraq was. And President Bush included it in his State of the Union speech in 2002. It was part of the Axis of Evil. And we really started to see an agenda being built early on in 2002. And, of course, those drums just got beat louder and louder and louder until the agenda setting became kind of consensus among the political elite and the military and the media. And so we just, and I would say that that culminated in the, when was it? It was February of 2003 when Colin Powell went before the UN and really kind of, as the media like to say, closed the deal for the Bush administration on reasons for invading, even though there was still very much a debate at that time about the wisdom of, you know, of attacking and going to war. And so that's, and then the invasion was launched in the, in, as you said, 6 years ago in March 19th in 2003. So, you know, what we saw was a kind of a lockstep that began really right after September 11th happened, with the administration looking at attacking Iraq in order to begin a policy of kind of, you know, solidifying power in the, in that region. And, you know, we that's another subject to go into, to look at the actual reasons rather than the spin.
Yes, in fact, I was going to approach that, but you're right. That would maybe perhaps take us off in a completely different
That's
direction.
That's another day, I think.
Yes. Loretta Alper is my guest, and she is the producer and co-director of War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death. She's a producer for the Media Education Foundation. You can go to mediaed.org and see a list of all their documentaries. Tell us some about the film. You go back to the Vietnam War, but I would say that if you began to ask people, you know, and you treat some of this, I mean, why did we invade Panama? Why did we invade Grenada? Why did, what happened to the Vietnam War? But we could go back, and I always try this with some of, when I speak to live audiences, and when I start talking about the kind of things that your film takes up, I said, why did the U.S. enter World War I? And here there's, you know, educated people in front of me, and you can just see this blank look, because no one really knows what. I mean, there's a few things that are, that people know the official explanations, but you go back to the Spanish American War, the Mexican American War, and most of the reasons are pretty shaky. I mean, we never got attacked like we did during World War II and the rest of it, right?
Well, I think the way that propaganda works is that you simplify and you repeat often. That's the sort of the formula for building a propaganda campaign, and the simpler the message, the better. And I think that's what we saw with this war, and that's what we saw in earlier wars, where the rationale was sort of, you know, fighting communism, and, you know, there always has to be a kind of larger kind of enemy boogeyman out there, and the umbrella reason of fighting the war on terror was certainly that was the kind of overreaching ambition of this war, but again, you know, ill-defined, and exactly what that meant, and, you know, what it was to mean in terms of strategy and goals and lives and cost was never really anticipated. It was supposed to be, this war was supposed to be quick and easy, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's what what we look at in the film, and I think what makes it so striking and makes the film continue to resonate with people, whether they know much about history or not, is just looking at the parallels of propaganda tactics used by administrations, both Democratic and Republican, to build the case for war and, you know, to fight a kind of elusive enemy out there, but, you know, always in terms of projecting power and, you know, always under the guise of usually more altruistic and loftier goals.
Well, now that we found out with the release of all the papers and what have you, the Soviet Union, we realize that they probably never constituted a threat. They never intended any invasion of Western Europe. They never, certainly never intended any attack on the United States. And probably the planners in the United States knew that, but it was necessary for a permanent industrial war economy and seeing an enemy, you know, the tiger at the village gate always mobilizes the people around support for the government in power. But I went to your website for the movie, warmadeeasythemovie.org, and there's some clips from the film itself. And the first one, I can't remember exactly, something about propaganda, but and you had a number of little clips from different people talking, some of it from the Iraq war and occupation, some from the Vietnam War. But it occurred to me that some of it, that we mentioned Al-Qaeda. And that is perceived, I would say correctly. I mean, here are these right-wing religious criminals that committed this horrendous act on September 11, 2001. And yet that become the idea to make the country safe from them, as well we should, is conflated with Iraq. Am I correct?
Oh, very much so. Yes, you are.
Yeah. Yeah, and so when facing a real enemy, that or at least that appears to be a real enemy, like the Soviet Union appeared to be real. I mean, I've seen films. They had kids up on the roofs of you know, as plane spotters, so they could spot the Russian bombers coming over that were going to drop like A bombs on Detroit. So, oh yeah, here they come. They're dropping an A bomb on us. So, but the whole duck and cover and yeah, and all of that. I mean, that just terrified people, and the idea of a strong military and of a strong nuclear defense made a lot of sense.
Yeah, fear is a very powerful mobilizer, and we saw a lot of that being used, as I mentioned, you know, pretty much in the right after September 11th with, the anthrax scare and dirty bombs, and, you know, we assembled. One thing that what we do at the Media Education Foundation that kind of sets us apart from other documentary filmmakers is we really monitor the media, and we look at the way in which the media uses certain ideas and narratives to shape our thinking about, you know, political issues and cultural issues. And so the film is really effective. What makes it so effective is its use of media clips, largely from network evening news broadcasts, right after September 11th, up until the invasion itself, of how the case for war was made, and the use of fear was a very, very powerful and effective force in those days after 9/11.
Yeah, give us an example, for instance, what we'd see in the film and what you think at the Media Education Foundation is an illegitimate manner in which media is used.
Well, I think the acceptance of the rationales for going to war without really challenging them, and the fear that got into journalists it was a very difficult time for journalists because they were intimidated by the administration. The administration very, very effectively got out in front of and was very effective in making their case, and so once those talking points were out there, once the generals were brought out in full force, all of those forces were marshaled and brought to bear on the on the media, on the news, on and news reporting. It was very difficult for people at that point. It took on a kind of life of its own and became very difficult for people to challenge the kind of conventional wisdom about the need to go to war.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask you, Loretta Alper, this, because I knew there were no weapons of mass destruction, and I just look at websites and read the media, but there was enough out there, wasn't there, for people like you and I assume you figured the same thing, that there weren't any weapons. This was totally constructed as a rationale for war. Am I right in this?
Well, if you even paid attention, you didn't have to listen to the voices in the peace movement or in the international community that were saying, asking questions. All you had to do was listen to people actually within government, within the CIA, within different branches of government. There were people who were questioning, and those people were largely shut out or they were pushed out. And they were effectively, I would say, silenced. And, so much so that Colin Powell presented a very faulty document that members of the intelligence community had decided shouldn't. There was information in there that members of the intelligence community said shouldn't be presented to the public. And it was presented as, gospel at the UN and to great fanfare. And so, there was a lot of skepticism and debate, and people with the knowledge, because the media tends to rely on official sources, and there were official sources, there were those people, but they were largely drowned out by the administrations, dogs of war.
Well, at the time, and I never understood exactly how the New York Times rationalized it as one of the major drum beaters for the war, and putting and just giving these spurious reports with that violated even their own standards of journalism, and trying to show that there were in fact weapons, and suddenly became these fierce critics of Bush and the war. Usually we say real easily, oh, they're the corporate media. That's why they do it. And they reply and they say, hey, we were just reporting the news. If a news piece begins, President George Bush today said that he's convinced that Iraq is building weapons of mass destruction, which contain a direct threat to the United States. He said, "Well, we're just reporting it. We're not.
And Congress used that excuse too. Everybody kind of threw up their hands, and I do think that the administration does ultimately bear responsibility, but the media, which is supposed to be watchdogs on government, and Congress, which is supposed to check and balance the White House, they abrogated their duties as well. And so I think people can say that, but they largely didn't do their jobs when it came to challenging and reporting. And the tragedy of you mentioned the New York Times and some of that reporting is that the administration then, in kind of a closed feedback loop, then referred to the New York Times. That was information that was planted, that came out of the White House, that came out of the vice president's office, and was fed to reporters at the New York Times, we now know. And then it was used to say, well, see, the New York Times says that there's weapons of mass destruction. So,
how
dangerous is that?
We were so disappointed, like National Public Radio, that we began calling nationalistic Pentagon or puppet radio. It seemed that everybody was on board, but it was pretty easy to see that there weren't weapons of mass destruction. None of Iraq's neighbors were worried. But we only have a few minutes left. And Loretta Alper, we are now moving from Bush's war, which we may now be entering Barack Obama's war in Afghanistan. Do you see those same forces at work? How presidents and pundits keep spinning us to death, the subtitle of your film?
Yes, I do. As I mentioned earlier, I see it in the case of Iraq, of the media having largely moved on from covering the war and challenging the official story now that we can't leave, and that the surge was a success, and that we cannot leave, and that a precipitous withdrawal would be a disaster, and that's very much the unchallenged storyline in Iraq. And then, yeah, as you mentioned, in Afghanistan, that's what we're seeing, again, in terms of the agenda setting and the consensus building. And, you know, we're seeing how it's just sort of become conventional wisdom that we have to have a kind of occupying force there, and we have to have a troop escalation there without really clearly asking why, without really clearly defining the mission or the goal, and what exactly the military can accomplish that, you know, the military hasn't exactly been able to accomplish in Iraq. It's a very much, I think, a parallel, very different economic, political, cultural circumstances in Afghanistan. But, you know, I think the question needs to be asked is, you know, can the so-called war on terror be fought through invasions and occupations?
Well, we now have a man that seems extremely bright in the White House, and that knows history and is not arrogant. So anyone that knows history knows that that Afghanistan is the boneyard of empires, of the British and the Russians, and into this century the Soviets, who had 500,000 men in there and could not contain the insurgency that was one of the key elements in their disintegration. It seems politically, which of course any president is concerned about, but also on the ground, is that the United States is damned if it does and damned if it doesn't. Either way, it seems like that we've been set up into a lose-lose situation.
And I think that's the problem, is that, you know, the generals and the are saying that we need more troops, and we need to leave troops in Iraq because, you know, it's a very much a what-if situation, and no one ultimately wants to be responsible for the disintegration of Iraq into chaos again. Or, you know, obviously we are seeing a deteriorating situation in Afghanistan, and I think the default position of the U.S. government is to, you know, think that problems can be solved militarily.
All right, we have just about a minute left, and as I've been saying all along, Loretta Alpert, you are a producer with Media Education Foundation, and its website is mediaed.org. Now, these are documentaries that are available to the public, am I correct?
Yes, I mean, they're mainly, we produce them for institutions, for colleges and libraries, and they're used in the classroom largely. That's how we got our start, was as making educational documentaries. But we've really, over the years, people have told us how much our films mean to them, how much they use them as individuals and in their communities. So we've adapted and tried to make our films more accessible to individuals. So if you go on the website, it'll tell you how, if you're an institution, you know, how to purchase a film, or if you're an individual. So, and War Made Easy certainly has its own website, because that film was intended to be made for the public, and we work very hard to get that film out there outside of our usual kind of classroom academic market.
Mm-hmm. And it's War Made Easy, themovie.org. And one of the things, listeners, that you can do, people are saying, I don't know what to do. I don't have contact with anybody. You can get one of these films. And this is a good one to start with. I've seen it. It's terrific, filled with the kind of information that you need, and you have a house party. Maybe you have 4 people, maybe you have 40 people, but it begins the process of getting people together. Well, Loretta Alper, I want to thank you so much for being with me. Let me just repeat all the information. The movie is War Made Easy, themovie.org, and it's War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death, a very important concept to grasp. The Media Education Foundation website is mediaed.org. If you're driving or something like that and it all just went by too quickly, you can go to my website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. Loretta Alpert, thanks for being with me on the program.
Oh, Peter, thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
This is Nightfall on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this.
Whoever controls technology controls the world.
The Riff has never been easier. On your Apple iPhone 3G, hit the iTunes Store, and download the free WRIF app. Connect with just one touch and listen to 101 WRIF from anywhere in the world. Details at WRIF.com. 101.
Are you struggling with too much credit card debt, sky-high interest rates, late fees, over-limit fees, having trouble just making the monthly minimums? We can help. We're Credit Card Relief. We've helped thousands of people become debt-free in months instead of years, all while saving thousands of dollars and without risking your family home. No, this isn't bankruptcy. It isn't one of those credit counseling deals or a high-interest consolidation loan. We're Credit Card Relief. We've been helping people just like you for nearly a decade. We're an attorney-driven program with an outstanding record of performance and client satisfaction. If you're serious about getting out of debt, call Credit Card Relief right now. Don't wait for the collection calls to start. The consultation is free, and the relief is real.
Call 866-290-8282. 866-290-8282. That's 866-290-8282.
Please stay tuned to the following public announcement. The government and private banks are liquidating houses now. These houses have been foreclosed, confiscated, or repossessed, and will be sold. Homes may be sold for very little money down. To learn how to receive a free list of foreclosures, call 800-354-8211. All listeners whose last name begins with the letter A through N are allowed to start calling now. Listeners whose last name begins with O through Z can begin calling tomorrow, 9 a.m. Every house must be sold. The government and banks are very motivated to sell these homes quickly, so listings may not always remain available in all areas. So act now. I repeat, this is a public announcement. All listeners whose last name begins with the letter A through N can start calling now. Listeners whose last name begins with O through Z can begin calling tomorrow, 9 a.m. Call CRN's national toll-free hotline to learn how to receive your free foreclosure list at 800-354-8211. That's 800-354-8211.
Is your debt getting bigger? Are you falling behind on your bills and receiving collection calls? Well, it's not your fault. Millions of Americans are buried in credit card debt because of a job loss, divorce, medical bills, or just bad luck. But now there's a way you can get debt-free faster than you ever imagined. Call Credit Card of America today for free information, and you'll learn how you can cut your monthly payments by up to half, lower or even eliminate your interest rates, and stop the collection calls once and for all. For free information, call 1-800-709-6136.
We owed $25,000 to the credit card companies. This year, we're going to be debt-free.
Credit Card of America won't just help you get debt-free. We'll even show you how to improve your credit status.
They helped me pay off 10 credit cards and rebuild my credit rating.
Call us today to learn how you can cut your monthly payments by up to half and get debt-free. For free information, call 1-800-709-6136. That's 1-800-709-6136.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. Well, you're listening to this station because it's a rock and roll station, and usually that's most of what we know about rock and roll. We know that they're stars. We listen to their music. Once in a while, we know about their personal lives, but very infrequently do we get a peek behind what makes it all happen. In other words, someone has to record. Someone has to have it distributed. It's a complex business, and who better to do it than Danny Goldberg? Danny Goldberg has been part of the rock and roll industry since the 1960s. He's been a journalist. He was a PR person, including doing PR for Led Zeppelin. A personal manager. He had clients like Nirvana and Bonnie Raitt. And he's also been the president of three major record companies, Atlantic, Warner, and Mercury. And if your memory goes back on this program, you may remember when I interviewed him in 2003 for his book, How the Left Lost Teen Spirit. He lives in New York, but we're reaching him in Los Angeles. Always a pleasure to welcome Danny Goldberg back to the Peter Werby Show. Hey, Danny.
Hey, Peter. Thanks so much for having me on.
Yeah, glad to. Always, because your insights are interesting and valuable for those of us that love the music and like a peek behind the scenes. I always like to do this, kind of go into the titles. Bumping into Geniuses. Give us the origin of the title.
It derives from something that Amon Erdogan used to say. Amon Erdogan was the chairman and founder of Atlantic Records. And when David Geffen was a young manager, managing Crosby, Stills, and Nash, he asked Amit how to become rich in the music business. And Amit said to him, the way to become rich is keep walking around until you bump into a genius, and then when you do, hold on and don't let go. That's how you become rich. So that story, when I got to Atlantic Records, was constantly repeated because, you know, it was a good story, but it also made the point that at the center of this group of businesses, which included then records, more than that now, concerts and songwriting and broadcasting and and all these other businesses, at the center of it was with these artists. And rock and roll especially was driven by artists. It wasn't driven by the record producers, the engineers, or outside songwriters. It was really driven by these strange, eccentric, sometimes damaged people who were able to make memorable rock and roll. And they really, although they were affected by the business, they also really affected the business because they had a lot of power starting in the late 60s once album sales exploded. So to me, it was a description of my career, which has been in the rock business, as you said, and when I've been successful, it's because I was lucky enough to bump into a genius and lucky enough to hold on to a relationship with him.
Mm-hmm. I suspect, though, Danny Goldberg, you're being a little too modest, because it does take an understanding of and a feel and an appreciation of an artist. I think a lot of people could bump into genius as a young, unsigned artist and be clueless about it. Maybe even tell us about Nirvana, because you kind of bumped into that genius. And
well, I certainly do consider Kurt Cobain one of the greatest, if not the greatest, I was able to work with. That was, I've been in the business for some time. This was, in the, very early 90s. Was managing, along with my partner at the time, John Silva, a band called Sonic Youth, who were really the most critically acclaimed and prestigious of what was then sort of the alternative rock subculture. The big rock bands at the time were bands like Whitesnake, Aerosmith, Guns N' Roses, and others that were sometimes lovingly called hair bands. And there was this sort of subculture of people who liked fanzines and listened to some college radio and went to certain clubs that wanted a real alternative to that, mostly driven by punk rock. And Sonic Youth had the jeweler's eye for the best of those artists. Told us about Nirvana, who'd put out an indie record that they'd recorded for $800 in Seattle, and had come out on a local label there and sold about 30,000, which although not a big number in economic terms, was a very impressive number for an indie release, and got the attention of the record companies. And we met them and hit it off with them right away. They were Sonic Youth kind of validated us to them, as well as the other way around. And they wanted to make a record deal with a major. They wanted a manager that was in the business. They were very fierce about protecting their artistic integrity and never would compromise on the lyrics, the sound, the artwork, how they played, who they talked to. But they wanted to reach people, and they weren't averse to that. And I didn't really understand how great they were until I saw the band live a couple of months later when they played in Los Angeles, and I just realized that Kurt Cobain, this is before Nevermind came out, but he'd written some of those songs, and the intimacy he had with an audience, they were actually opening for Dinosaur Jr. in L.A., the way he merged his personality with that of the audience and made, it was just such a magical connection. I knew after that I was really involved with somebody extraordinary. I didn't know it was going to be such a big commercial success, but I knew this guy was really one in a million.
And certainly a tragic end to Kurt Cobain's life, and many people felt sort of emblematic. I'm not sure that's actually correct, but emblematic of that particular era. Were you still associated with him when he took his own life?
Yeah, I was. I was. I gave one of the eulogies at his funeral at Courtney's request, and I'd gone to work for Atlantic Records by then, but I was, in my deal with them, permitted to co-manage Nirvana. There was an intervention to try to get him into rehab that I described in the book about a week earlier, and I was still, I stayed connected to him until he died. It's an unbelievable tragedy, and anyone who's ever been friends with or worked with someone who killed themselves, you never really get over it. I always question myself, should I have said something to him different? Would there have been a different therapy, a different some spiritual solution, some medical solution that we didn't think of, some personal gesture that I could have made or sentence I could have uttered? But I think we did the best we knew how to do at the time, and there were a couple of interventions, and he went to rehab different times, and he had pain, I think, derived from his childhood. Long before he was successful, he was up in our office one day moping around, and one of the people in the office said to him, what are you in such a bad mood for? And he looked up and he says, I'm awake, aren't I? So he always had kind of a depressive streak. He'd had a history with drugs before he became famous, and the combination of that and the experience of becoming successful And whatever was going on in his inner soul, you know, caused him to kill himself. For some weird reason, a number of rock stars killed themselves at the age of 27. Jim Morrison, Jimi Hendrix, and Janis Joplin, Brian Jones, the Rolling Stone. I don't know what it is about that age. But in his professional mode, he was unbelievably brilliant and effective. You know, when he was doing his work, he wrote all the lyrics, he wrote all the music, he was the lead singer, he was the lead guitar player. He designed the album covers, he would do a detailed drawing of exactly what he wanted. He wrote the scripts for the music video shot by shot. He even designed the t-shirts. You know, I was with him many times when he just on a napkin sketched what he wanted the next t-shirt to be. He was really a genius when it came to having the full-blown three-dimensional vision of what Nirvana was going to be and how to maintain it and develop it. Doing the Unplugged was his idea, et cetera, et cetera. But, and he loved his daughter, and I believe he loved Courtney very, very much, although they, you know, like any couples, they had their ups and downs. There's no question he was crazy about her. But, there was a dark side of him that he only turned on himself that resulted in his tragic death. But I think the legacy left of his music is indisputable. It still holds up today. You know, there's several generations of come and gone, and teenagers today still hear Kurt Cobain's voice and feel somebody understands them.
Sure. The book is Bumping Into Geniuses, My Life Inside the Rock and Roll Business. Danny Goldberg is my guest. You go to DannyGoldberg.com. There's an introduction to the book there. And there'll also be a link on my site, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. Let's go back quite a few years and go to the subtitle of your book, My Life Inside the Rock and Roll Business. Well, when you began in the late 1960s, we all knew that there was a business aspect to it, but mostly it was the creativity. It was the era. It was the zeitgeist, if you will. Were you shocked at any point to realize that, wait a minute, this is an industry. This is a business. This isn't just about the music.
Yeah, I was very surprised. I got my first job. I was 18. I just wasn't set out for college at that point. I dropped out after about a week. I wanted to get my own apartment and threw an ad in the New York Times, got a clerical job at a magazine called Billboard. And I thought it was about, signs on the highways. I didn't really know there was a music business. And I certainly didn't know there was such a thing as a trade magazine or promotion people or publicists. In the intervening years, there's been kind of a mythology about the business. But at that time, I just thought they were the artists and the fans. And, my job was calling the stores to ask what was selling, and that created the raw data from which they made up the charts. And that's when I learned there was such a thing as charts. And, again, today they're printed in newspapers, but then it was just purely an industry phenomenon. And I discovered there were people on the other side of the office that got paid to go to concerts and write their opinions about them. And I didn't have very high self-esteem at that point, but I knew I could do that. I knew I could go to a rock concert and write my opinions about it. I was a huge fan of 60s rock. It had gotten me through high school psychologically, and I still loved it. And the older writers that were the more seasoned senior writers didn't like rock and roll. It was that generational divide. They liked to go to nightclubs where they could get free drinks and a dinner, see jazz or pop or R&B acts. And so, for example, when the Woodstock Festival happened, they assigned it to me because nobody else wanted to cover it.
That's amazing. And you were part of the scene. You weren't writing as an outsider the way those other, quote, critics were.
Well, I was 19 at the time of Woodstock, and I felt like more part of the audience than a journalist. I did go up in a limo, and I did have a hotel, with the press agent for Woodstock, and I had a hotel room, so I didn't get as muddy as all the other people did who were sleeping on the ground during the rainfall. But I emotionally felt very much part of the audience. I wrote rhapsodically about it. It was an amazing thing to be part of that sense of community and love, for that couple of days. I think the movie actually captured that aspect of it quite well. But there was a lot more music than they could fit into the movie, and it was certainly a good turning point for me to have that, sort of more major piece published under my byline, and allowed me to get some more attention later on as a so-called rock writer.
Well, you're a rock writer. You're interviewing people. Suddenly, you're going right up the stairs and wind up as president of three major record companies.
Well, it wasn't exactly suddenly. It took me about 20 years.
Yeah, okay. Go ahead. What was the process? I mean, you were PR, PR for Led Zeppelin?
Well, what I found is, although I was able to write some reviews for Rolling Stone and some of the other magazines, there was a terrific Detroit-based magazine called Cream that I wrote for once or twice, and a magazine called Circus that I edited for a while. But I wasn't really set out to be a critic. I was too much of a fan. The really popular and respected critics were critical, and they would make fun of a bad guitarist or be have high, look for the weak spots in an album and try to create this this set of standards that was sort of more rigorous than what whatever radio was doing. And I was just too much of a fan. I felt guilty whenever I wrote something bad about a musician, and I never therefore had a big success as a critic. But those attributes made me very effective as a PR guy, public relations guy. And I knew all the writers, at least all the New York writers who were writing about rock and roll, which was a lot of them lived in New York. As a PR guy, I got a job with a showbiz PR agency that wanted a rock kid with long hair. And soon after I started, Led Zeppelin became a client, and that was really the turning point to my career because they were the biggest band in the world.
Did you have ambitions? I mean, did you think one day I'm going to be the head of a record company? I mean, was that?
Well, at first I didn't have any ambitions. Up until I was around 23, first 4 or 5 years, my main ambition was to meet girls and to just kind of have fun and have something to do at night.
Sure.
But once I started doing PR for Led Zeppelin, I was a little older, a little more conscious of having to pay the bills, and maybe it just had to do with my age, getting to be 23, 24. I worked for them between the time I was 23 and 26, and by the end of that time, I really was ambitious. I wanted to be successful in the business. It wasn't about specifically being a record company president. It was just about being successful. What I really admired then was the managers, because Peter Grant, the manager of Led Zeppelin, was this very brilliant, tough, and intimidating guy who seemed to boss everybody around, including the label. But over time, there came a time later on when I wanted to get into the record business side. But the key to it for me was my relationship with artists and the track record I had of working with successful artists. Other people made it through being great lawyers, great musicians, great radio promotion people. But mine was really through my relationships with the artists. So that's why I feel so obligated to them.
Well, it would be a pleasure. And I saw right away, the typical Detroiter, of all the things in your book, bumping into geniuses, I immediately turned to the M's to see what you had to say about Detroit's own MC5.
Well, the MC5 were so important culturally. They never had the mass appeal of Bob Seger or some of the other artists that came out of Detroit, but they were incredibly influential on other artists. They were overtly political. They had raw energy that was transformative. They were the darlings of a lot of the New York critics, because by this time the critics wanted to have favorites that weren't getting played on all the big radio stations. And I saw them in New York and wrote a good column about them. And as a result, the guy who originally signed them, Danny Fields, asked me to have lunch with them. And that's how I met a lot of the important critics and people in the New York music business was because of that. So I have this tremendous personal debt to the MC5. But, it was easy to write a good review. And they were a great band. And I think they really helped set the stage for punk rock. I think you can see influence between what they did and bands like Rage Against the Machine. And you see today, I manage Tom Morello today from Rage Against the Machine. He's very good friends and has played a lot with Wayne Kramer from the MC5. I think you see their influence on the Sex Pistols, their influence on Nirvana and Pearl Jam, and they were an incredibly influential band, even though they never had the big pop songs.
Yeah, that's interesting. They were, I forget which way it goes, but I think it's the sum of parts are greater than the whole. I mean, the influence that the MC5 has still is
Well, they were,
absolutely
they were unashamedly political. They were against the war in Vietnam. They were for the empowerment of working people. And they also made great, loud, unadorned rock music at a time when a lot of groups were playing around with tricks in the studio to make their production sound more pop and more elaborate. And all of those qualities made them heroes to the punk rock generation. And they still are. So it's one of the great contributions that Detroit made to the world of rock and roll. It's not just in the United States, by the way. You go anywhere in the world where rock and roll is popular, which is most of the world, and people know who the MC5 is.
Mm-hmm. Dan Goldberg, you just mentioned about the MC5 and their politics. You now run Gold Village Entertainment, and that includes Steve Earle and Tom Morello, as you said. Also, The Hives, a wonderful band.
Yeah.
But like Steve Earle and Tom Morello are very overtly on the left. Is that still a big factor in rock and roll music?
No, I think every artist. I've worked with artists who are Republicans. I mean, my main interest is if they're good artists and good people to work with and work fit for our business. But I I think is part of the culture of music that is political and is left wing. I think its legacy that goes back to Woody Guthrie and Pete Seeger runs through the Vietnam War, when a lot of artists like the Jefferson Airplane and Country Joe and the Fish were anti-war. And I think that although there are some artists like Kiss who I used to work with, I mean, Gene Simmons, who's a good friend of mine, has become a Republican, and I wish he weren't. But a lot of artists, I think, are anti-war, are very much in favor of opportunity for working people, root for the underdog, are naturally sort of anti-establishment. And I think you've seen some of that and as part of the energy of the Obama campaign, certainly a lot of the energy of the anti-war movement. And not everybody I work with feels that way, but I'm really excited that I get to work with those two artists who are very activist and political, although they're both more issue-driven than candidate-driven. And, you know, Steve's ardently against the death penalty, and Tom is very close to the Iraq veterans against the war, among others.
Well, getting back to the subtitle of Bumping Into Geniuses, My Life Inside the Rock and Roll Business, this is a shaky time for companies that are trying to sell CDs. Any thought where this is all going? I mean,
I think the main thought is that concerts are becoming more and more the primary business, and recordings are becoming a secondary business. That it's hard to imagine how the big companies can reverse the trend that has reduced record sales. There's still a record business. There's a vinyl business. There's a box set business. There's electronic services like iTunes, and there are still CD sales. They're just about, you know, half of what they used to be, but you can still get them in a bunch of stores, you know, Walmart and Best Buy and Barnes and Noble and Borders and so on. But a lot of pure record stores have closed because it's so easy for kids and others to get albums illegally for free. And even if they buy them legally on a service like iTunes, they're more inclined to buy just their favorite individual songs than the whole album. So it's billions of dollars of lost revenue and thousands of jobs lost, and that may never come back. It may just be a trend based on technology that's irreversible. But the popularity of music is the most it's ever been. More people in the world love music. The internet allows people to trade music with their friends, and that creates an incredible market for concerts, for club performances, for merchandise, selling things like T-shirts, things that you can force payment of. You try to get into a concert for free, there's a big guy that won't let you in. So that business is thriving, and I think artists have to think more of those other income streams and look at recordings as sort of their legacy and a promotional device, but it doesn't have any of the kind of economic power that it used to have, and record companies have much smaller staffs than they used to have, and that may be irreversible. But music itself is still a gigantic business based on concerts, licensing of songs to music videos, video games and movies and so on, and T-shirts and things like that.
There have probably never been so many young people in bands. In fact, middle-aged people are still in these bands. And they're all hoping that somebody like Danny Goldberg will bump into their genius. And some of the stations have, like, local music shows.
Yeah.
And sometimes local bands have said, what can I do to be a success? And besides saying, honing your craft and having it, I said, I don't know. I just don't know. Where is the genius?
There's the most important thing is the songs. Having a memorable song is the single biggest predictor of success. The second most important thing is learning how to do an entertaining show, because if you do a great show, you're going to be invited back, you're going to build fans, and they're going to sustain you. The third most important thing is figuring out how to get attention, whether it's through giving compelling interviews or fashion sense or something like that. And the fourth important thing is luck. Just perseverance tends to pay off, but exactly when and how it pays off is not always predictable. And you can't beat yourself up if you're having a tough year. If you believe in yourself and you've got fans and people around you, you just got to keep doing it. There's countless stories of artists who struggled for years and then had breakthroughs. But not everybody who's the best band in their high school or the best band in their hometown is destined to make a living doing it. You know, there's only a certain amount of appetite. And, of course, rock and roll is not the only game in town anymore. The last 20 years, hip-hop has commanded a big part of the psychic real estate of teenagers, and rock and roll still exists, but it's a smaller piece of the pie. But there's constantly new bands who do make it, and you look at a band like My Morning Jacket or Arcade Fire or Bright Eyes. I mean, there's so many interesting bands that are still emerging. So it's still a path that will work for some people, but it takes skill, luck, a lot of hard work, and talent.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining me on the Peter Werbe Show. Danny Goldberg has been my guest. The book is Bumping Into Geniuses, My Life Inside the Rock and Roll Business. And as always, Danny, a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you so much for having me on, Peter.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Riff Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit. The home of WRIF.com. Get the latest rock news, concert listings, and where Riff is rocking the streets. Check out Motor City's deals and deals and get stuff for half price. Or get 101 The Riff online from anywhere in the world.
Website.
Worldwide.
101 WRIF and WRIF.com. Everything rocks.
If your credit card debt has gotten out of control, if you're over your head at monthly payments, here's one powerful secret the credit card companies don't want you to know. You have the right to settle your credit card debt for a fraction of what you owe, allowing you to cut your debt up to half or more. That's bad news for credit card companies, but it's great news for you. We're Consumer Debt Advocate, and we'd like to offer you a free consultation that will help you start eliminating credit card debt. For your free consultation that will set you free, call 1-800-984-6953. Don't ruin your credit by declaring bankruptcy. Settle your debt and move on with your life. During your free consultation, you'll find out what the credit card companies don't want you to know. For your free consultation that will help you settle your credit card debt for a fraction of what you owe, call today. The number is 1-800-984-6953. 1-800-984-6953.
Attention! Hydralyze is currently seeking participants with dark circles and puffy eyes. If you have dark circles or bags around your eyes due to heredity, fatigue, or aging, you are eligible to see results and participate in the Hydralyze trial. Hydralyze was introduced to improve delicate skin around the eyes and now has been shown to eliminate dark circles and bags. It effectively diminishes even dark circles caused by heredity. To participate in the Hydralyze trial and see results risk-free, call 1-800-505-7931. Fragile capillaries around the eye can leak, allowing blood to pool beneath the skin like an ugly bruise. But right now, you can join the thousands of people who have seen their dark circles fade away, watched as bags literally disappeared from view. Participate in the free trial by calling today. If you're serious about getting rid of your dark circles or bags around the eyes, you are eligible to participate and experience results with Hydralyze. Call this number today, 1-800-505-7931. Once more, that's 1-800-505-7931.
Did you know the tap water in your home may be hazardous? Not to your health, but to your appliances and your wallet. Your home's hard water creates pipe-clogging lime scale, and that can shorten the life of your water heater, ruin your dishwasher, and break down your washing machine. Lime scale deposits block the heating element, which costs you up to 25% more. That's an extra $1,200 a year in energy and wear. But you can remove lime scale without chemicals, magnets, or salts. It's easy. With HydraCare, the patented device used worldwide. See for yourself at bestsoftwater.com. You simply clip HydraCare to your main water pipe. HydraCare removes and prevents lime scale buildup in your entire plumbing system. Guaranteed. If your home has hard water, extend the life of your appliances and save money with HydraCare. Just go to bestsoftwater.com. Lower your energy costs. Visit bestsoftwater.com. That's bestsoftwater.com.
Ladies and gentlemen,
all right, listen up.
To the Rock 101 WRIF, everything that rocks.